Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 270. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today are James Jones.
What?
Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, hoy.
And the friendly ghost, Carl Castaneda.
Let's not promise anything, okay?
I'm promising that you won't be the friendly ghost this time. Yeah, Carl is rejoining us just a few weeks ago. He was on the show, but then he wasn't on the show. So we wanted to give him a chance to redeem himself a little and make his presence felt this time.
More pressingly, we're rocking a Lindemann-free radio.
So. Yes, unfortunately, John had to work late today, so...
Radio-free Lindemann. There you go.
We miss him, and we will hope to have him back next week.
Miss is a strong word.
It's not nearly strong enough for me.
Well, that would explain some things.
So, we have a really big show for you today. We've got some, we're going to talk about some news stuff because it's been such a weirdly major week for news. And then we've got a bunch of game impressions in new business, and we've got some more listener mail this week. So we're going to jump right into it. Carl is first with a Nintendo game.
That's right. Now, if you guys have always heard my recent appearance on the show, I usually have something from iOS or an Xbox game or something like that, but today I actually have...
Though they haven't heard you recently.
Well, there's that as well,
mission
yeah.
Mission failed.
But today I have two downloadable games to talk about, and the first one's actually on the 3DS, and that is Pushmo, and it actually came out today, the day they're recording this, on Thursday.
Brand new game.
I got it at Neil's recommendation. He'd been playing it earlier today, and he really liked it a lot. Basically, it's from Intelligent Systems, actually. And the way it works is that it's a puzzle platformer, and you're sort of facing this giant wall split up into various shapes, and you can pull the shapes out at a maximum of 3 spaces back. And so you sort of have to pull the shapes out in a way that constructs the stairs so you can get to the top.
So it's Catherine?
I'm not familiar with that.
No, it's not because there's no really disturbed scenes about emotional love interests and an abusive girlfriend.
Well, there is a weird story about a neighborhood kid who keeps locking up babies.
So it's what is that?
Not that far from Catherine, actually.
And yeah, so it's basically this dick is going around locking up children in drawers.
So it's a Pushmo dick.
And so then you have to get to the top so you can sort of get the baby out and get him back to safety. And you're dressed up as this sort of sumo wrestler, thus Pushmo.
You know, I'm not sure if this is real or if Carl just planned all this in advance.
There are elements of reality in what Carl's saying.
I can't wait to play this. I'm sure you haven't had a lot of time with it, Carl, but...
Actually, I have. I've played... 50 of the puzzles so far.
Wow, that's quick. I mean, I downloaded it today as well. And so, yeah, it's, you know, puzzle platform game. It's like creating, you know, a path out of a chest of drawers.
Yeah,
that chest of drawers may be a pixel art thing of Mario's head. But it's got a lot in common with Cat Trap, actually, the virtual console game on the 3DS, because you can rewind time to undo things, which is something that Catherine also has, doesn't it? To continue that analogy.
Not that I've played it.
And then also it has the create your own level feature that Cat Trap had. So a bit easier to propagate your levels through QR codes than it was through the passwords, probably, for Cat Trap.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I've been really liking it.
Yeah, I'll probably pick it up. I've heard a lot of good things from our... Japan correspondents, and you know, it's been out for a while in Japan. They've actually already done an update, which is included in the version that's out now, but they added the whole QR code thing to an updated version in Japan. So it's really been out for several weeks, and I've heard only good things about it. So I'll probably pick it up. I'm down for another 3DS download title. This week has been so good for 3DS. So good.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get into that a little bit later.
Well, except for the one game that's billed in its own press release as being the worst game ever made.
What?
there is a game on the download press release this week that is being billed as a feature as, quote, the worst game ever made.
And what is that, James? Please enlighten us.
Just some shitty tower defense game.
Why would they call it the worst game ever made?
That's their shtick. I don't know.
They think that will sell more copies?
Yes.
they'll sell to James Jones.
No, I honestly just thought to myself, great, if I were still writing downloads, this would be perfect. But I'm not.
Neither is Nintendo.
In any case, I would say go ahead and pick up Pushmo. It's only $7, I think, and you get about in the neighborhood of around 200 puzzles in the game, which is pretty nice. But anyway, the second game that I've been playing a little bit more briefly is Infinity Blade 2. Now, Johnny, you played the first one, didn't you?
I did, and I like it. I don't love it, but I like it. I got bored with it pretty quickly because it is very repetitive. But
it is extremely repetitive, yeah.
Damn pretty. And it has pretty solid punch-out mechanics. I thought about picking up the sequel when it came out last week, but I decided that I didn't love the first one so much that I needed to get the sequel right off the bat, and knowing that they will put it on sale eventually, I said, I can wait.
Sure. Well, I'd sort of had the itch to play some more Infinity Blade recently, and I was like, you know what, I'll just wait for the second one. And I'm glad I did. They've added a few new mechanics to this combat system that makes it a little less repetitive. They've added parrying, and you can sort of now run out of dodges, so you sort of have a stamina that you have to keep up, which sort of changed up the rhythm of the fighting. Unfortunately, I was really excited when this game started because it puts you in sort of this feudal Japan sort of setting, and I was like, awesome, they're not going to just do the castle setting again, which was done to death in the first game. And you fight this really cool boss, and you're like, all right, I'm really into this. They added a ton of new story stuff. There's now, like, way more dialogue in the game. They're really upping the production value. And literally, once you finish the prologue, they drop you in a fucking castle.
Nice!
I haven't played beyond that part so far, so I don't know if they change it up, but I really hope they do, because, good God, that's going to get annoying. Infinity Blade is sound. It's a good game, but ultimately, you get tired of playing the same 30-minute or, you know, probably less chunk ad nauseum until you can eventually beat, you know, the boss.
Yeah, it's basically a grind game. Like, it's a very, very short experience that you're asked to play through multiple times with very slight variations each time you go through it.
Yeah.
With the purpose of building up your character until you're strong enough and you have a good enough equipment that you can actually defeat the boss at the end rather than just be killed every time you see him.
Now, what I'm hoping is that they continue to use the story stuff, and they're sort of adding some more story to the fact that you're constantly revived. You actually see the main dude without his armor. Because the whole thing is that, you know, in the first Infinity Blade, everyone's wearing this sort of, like, top-to-bottom armor. You don't even see anyone's faces.
Right.
And, you know, so what do they do in the sequel? They actually show you his face. They show you him talking to other people. And so they're really beefing up the story in this, which is great. It really adds a lot more to the experience, but I don't know if it's enough for me to play beyond the first cycle. I'll see what happens after the first cycle and sort of make my decision from there. But so far, I'm liking it enough.
So it could become Finite Blade 2?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that sort of is dragging it down for me is that they might have gone a little too nuts with the graphics.
What do you mean, too nuts?
Well, I mean, it looks really, really good, but it's pushing my iPad 2 pretty hard. And that is the most advanced version of iOS hardware right now. So if it's like slowing down and choppy on that, I can't imagine what it's going to look like on a 3GS, which is like the lowest version of the hardware that it supports.
Isn't it optimized for the iPhone 4S?
Well, the iPad 2 has better specs than the iPhone 4S, though.
But if it's trying to run it at a higher resolution or something like that.
Maybe, yeah, that's a good point. But in any case, I was sort of taken aback by that because the first Infinity Blade runs super smooth. I mean, there's no slowdown, there's no, you know, the anti-aliasing is really, really good. And in the second one, it just it feels like they might have just pushed it a little too far. Too many things happening on screen at once, a little too many particle effects, that kind of thing. But I'm sure it'll look great on next year's hardware when that happens.
Yeah, just buy another $600 phone.
For a game.
Yeah,
singular.
Yeah, yeah. For a, at least though, they did lower the price for this one. I think when the first Infinity Blade came out, it was, might have been $11.99, and now they launched this one at only $7. So that's good.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is what I have been playing this week.
Well, I hope that game funds Shadow Complex too.
I mean, I really hope so too. That was a really good game, and I would love to play another one.
So I'll go next, and I play a lot of Zelda this week. Don't really have anything new to say about it. I'm as far as James was last week, so I'm still kind of running.
So you haven't quite gotten to what Greg was alluding to.
No, I still don't know what he's talking about. I am right before the sixth dungeon.
Yeah, fuck that game. That's what he's talking about. I actually sent Greg an email when I hit that point and literally said this is the worst thing anyone has ever
done. It's worth mentioning that the only amount of pleasure I got from the section of that game is knowing how much James would hate it.
It really is that unnecessary.
I'll try to keep that in mind as I go through it. But I think I have a higher tolerance for collecting Baphmo dads than you guys do.
Oh, I don't think anyone could appreciate this. This is DK64 shit right here.
So I'm not there yet. I think I'm right before the sixth dungeon. And I have to say, the last couple items I got, I'm a little disappointed with. They just seem... There's a sword upgrade that is profoundly disappointing when you get it.
Oh, I know exactly which one it is. It's like, yeah. Wait, what?
Great.
Well, to be fair, the first sword upgrade you get, you're like, well, damn, how are they going to top this? And then you go, oh, they don't.
Yeah, they don't even try. But I'm holding out hope for the next one. So anyway, I'm really enjoying Zelda, and I have found that I have spent, I think like John, I am a little bit prone to do side quests and get distracted by them, and I have found that I have probably spent at least 5 or 6 hours just running around collecting stuff, just the materials that you craft with, and the bugs. I'm still not even really sure what the point of collecting the bugs are. They don't
potion upgrades.
Yeah, that's not very useful at all.
For one of them it is.
Well, I've started just selling them for the most part, selling the bugs.
Yeah, cash that could be useful for.
And then the crafting stuff. Actually, I really enjoy finding those materials, especially the ones that are kind of in predictable locations where they kind of pop up in places where it's logical that they would pop up. I just wish there was more stuff you could spend those materials on. The crafting system feels pretty limited, just in that I've easily crafted everything that you can craft. I've upgraded everything that you can upgrade, and I've got tons of materials left over. And I kind of feel like, considering how much junk they dish out at you, they don't really give you enough to use it for. And now that I've got almost everything now, I don't really think there's a big chunk of upgrades that are coming my way. So I feel like, well, I liked doing that stuff. I just wish there was more of it, you know, and that it was maybe a little bit more rewarding, the upgrades that you get. But yeah, I'm still enjoying that game a hell of a lot. So it has not worn thin on me yet. But I'm 32 hours in or so, and I've still got a ways to go. I'm well aware of that. But the main thing that I wanted to talk about this week is Mario Kart 7, because it did come out in the interim since our last recording. And it came out in North America, at least. So I picked it up, a couple days after launch. I did the Amazon thing, so I said, you know, I don't need to go get in line at GameStop.
It's Mario Kart.
I know what it is. I can wait 2 extra days to play it. I've got plenty of other stuff to play. But I have played it quite a bit since it came in, and I am liking it a lot. And I think I did play some online stuff, and I thought I was very impressed by that. I thought the interface for it was really good. There was no lag I could detect, no slowdown or anything like that. I actually joined the NWR community, which if you haven't done that yet, you definitely should. There's an article up on the site where you can get the code for that, and there weren't as many people in it as I expected when I joined it. So I think we need to spread the word a little bit, because the nice thing about the community is that there's a place in the menu where you can go and always find people playing, and there's a good chance you will know at least one of those people from the forums or from, you know, the podcast or from Twitter or whatever you do on the internet. But if you are actually involved somehow in the Nintendo World Report community, you will probably recognize someone who is in that community room, and you'll have people there who are ready to play. And that's very valuable, because the random, you know, like the global random matching can take a while, and plus you get in there with a bunch of cheaters and, you know, just random people who you have no connection with whatsoever. And then the friend play, people who are in your friend list may or may not be playing at the same time you are. So short of actually like setting up a play date with them, they may not be available when you're ready to play. So the NWR community is kind of a friendly place you can always go to and just find people to play with. I ended up playing about half an hour of battle mode online with these guys, which is the first time I've ever really played battle mode online. I mean, you can do it in the Wii game, but only in the team stuff, and it really didn't seem all that much fun to me when I did it. This was really fun, and I like that they have some retro battle arenas in there as well. So I had a great time doing that, and there were only three of us, and it would be a lot more fun with more people, but even with just the three of us, it was strategic, and it was exciting, and it was competitive, and I had a great time, and that wasn't even racing. You know, I did a couple races too, but that was like almost the first thing I did when I turned the game on, and I lost terribly because I didn't know the tracks and, you know, I didn't know how to use the new items and stuff like that. But, I have enjoyed Mario Kart. I will say I'm sort of grinding through the Grand Prix stuff just because I want to unlock everything. And I reviewed Mario Kart Wii. I played plenty of DS. I played a ton of Double Dash. And the only one of those games where I felt like the Grand Prix was actually fun at all, really, is Double Dash, because you could play it in co-op. And we had, my friend Taylor and I had really good times playing Double Dash co-op, and even just against the computer, you know, but we were playing together, and that was so much more fun. And I have to say, all these other games where you play by yourself, the Grand Prix just isn't fun.
It's just a good way to get familiar with the tracks.
Yeah.
Before you do something else, that's all I can say for it, really.
Yeah.
Because it's very predictable, the way it kind of ramps up, you know, obviously the speed ramps up, but also the intensity with which you'll get bombarded with items will ramp up as well. That's one of the sort of principal ways in which it gets more difficult, which is, you know, pretty crude, to say the least.
Yeah, I think the stuff like the blue shell and, you know, somebody bowling you over with a bullet or whatever, all that crazy stuff that can happen in the thick of the race, I don't mind it at all when you're playing against people, whether it's local or online. That does not bother me. I think that stuff is in the spirit of the game. But against the computer, when my only reason for playing this is just to get to the end with a gold, that is not fun. That's just frustrating. When that stuff happens to you, when you're in first for the entire race, and at 10 seconds before the finish line, you get hit by three things at once, and you end up finishing in sixth. I didn't learn anything from that. I didn't gain any kind of valuable experience from doing that. All that means is that I just wasted 20 minutes of my time trying to beat this Grand Prix. And it really adds nothing to the experience. And I don't understand why Nintendo can't get the message that Mario Kart Grand Prix is broken. And it has been for a long time. But I think it's become more and more broken because, you know, in the old games, you didn't really have to unlock stuff. So if you didn't want to play Grand Prix, you just didn't.
But is that really broken, though, or is that just not fun? I mean, there's a difference.
If it's not fun, that means it's broken.
No, broken means it doesn't do what it sets out to do, which is be a racing game. I would say it's just not enjoyable.
In this case, though, I think that they've kind of, the way the unlockables, from what I've seen, having done all the cups, if I'm remembering correctly, the only thing that you unlock from the cups is characters.
That's the big one. I would like to get all the characters, you know.
But they are completely superfluous now, because the pieces of cart are really what, you know, make the difference in terms of what kind of handling, what kind of acceleration, top speed, etc. you're going to have. I mean, they are just avatars. So I think if you do all the 100cc stuff, you get your own Mii, which is still ridiculous that you have to unlock your Mii.
Yes,
that's kind of bizarre.
It's like the most casual feature, and it's the most hardcore.
I would actually say you should be able to use 100 points to lock everyone else's me out of races.
We don't want BJ making a comeback, do we?
No.
The 150cc, I think you get a character for each cup. So you start off with the...
Well, if you get the gold.
Yeah, if you get the gold, that's right. But in terms of the important stuff, really, you get for the coins, mentioned last week. And you get those coins, you know, if you, as you, you know, alluded to yourself in anticipation, you know, even if you lose the cup frustratingly, well, you still accumulated the coins from those races. And if you go online, the coins there count towards your total. So, to be honest, you could probably ignore the Grand Prix to a large extent. And if you just wanted to kind of unlock a specific character, look it up on Game trade facts and then do the one, like, 150cc cup you need. If you really must play as the Honey Queen from Super Mario Galaxy, then you can do that.
Why?
I got her and I didn't even want
Why?
Her. I might do that. I might even go to that step to just be selective about who I try to unlock, because I don't want to develop a relationship with this game that I did with Mario Kart Wii. And I was reviewing it, to be fair, so I wanted to be thorough anyway. But I played the Grand Prix so much trying to unlock Dry Bowser. And that is very, very hard to do. And that game, winning that game is so, you get to a certain level where it's really arbitrary whether or not you win a race. And you have to win several in a row to actually get what you want. And it got to the point where I felt like, well, I'm good enough to do this. The question is, will the game let me win? And it got to the point where I just had to do the Grand Prix over and over and over and over again and hope that the slot machine lined up in just the right way that I actually got through it with all golds. And that's not fun. It's really not. And it made me hate that game. After I wrote the review and everything, I just got to the point where I did not want to play it anymore because I was so angry at it. And I don't want to feel that way about Mario Kart. It's a fun, happy, it's a sweet game. I mean, it's just the way that this stuff is structured is bad. And I think there is a way to make Mario Kart fun to play as a single player, and they're ignoring it.
Well, you just have to restructure it. You have to actually differentiate it from, you know, what works from the point of view of, you know, something like the Blue Shell. James talked about last week, you know, it's like, oh, let me just affect the outcome of this race for people other than myself, you know, that doesn't actually benefit me at all. The thing is, if that's amongst four friends, that's funny.
Yeah,
it's like, right. Well,
unless you're the douchebag who fired it, because then you're going to get punched in the face.
Well, but the other guy is going to be saying, thanks, mate. You know, I'll have that. You know, so that's kind of funny kind of thing. But you know, when it's one computer character doing you in and letting another computer character win and all that, it just doesn't make sense. It's not really, you know, it doesn't really sort of do much for you. So, I mean, I think you could have, for instance, items that are completely unique to the single player mode, and then ones that would be unique to the multiplayer mode. And you could have sort of elements of challenges. You know, think obviously Diddy Kong Racing did quite a bit more in this area with sort of boss races.
Now that game can be frustrating in certain places, but I think the Diddy Kong Racing single player experience is far better than any Mario Kart game. And another one that I'm thinking about is, like, I don't know that I've ever had more fun in a single-player racing game than in Excite Truck and Excite Bots. I think those games, because you can do well without winning the race, they incur that, you know, what matters is not necessarily the final result so much as how you play throughout the entire race. And to me, that's way more fun.
There's another route they could go to different. Yeah. I think the main thing is, you know, as long as it's just sort of this shell of the proper experience, which is the multiplayer, that's all it will be. It's just like a little bit of practice, get to know the courses and all that, and then that's it. So at the moment, it's kind of untapped potential, I feel like. But at the same time, as the way it's set up now, if it's just going to annoy you, don't bother with it. Learn the tracks online. And I think what you'll find is that everything balances out a lot better online.
Oh, it does. It's so much more fun to play online.
It's not rigged to be a certain probability that, you know, you're going to get kind of shafted to bring you back to the pack a bit. You know, that will happen, but it feels far more balanced because it's just your eight people going at it. And also, the field can be incredibly condensed compared to the one-player game. You know, the one-player game is all is sort of spaced out very deliberately. There's a couple of guys that are going to race a lot better than the other ones, and they're kind of your rivals across the cup. And
it's so predetermined.
Yeah, exactly. And it's this rubber banding of all different sorts that holds that predetermined thing together. But then with online, sometimes your people could be way back if they get really screwed over, or maybe they don't know the track so well. But on the other hand, it could be so incredibly condensed that you could go literally from worst to first in the span of, you know, a couple of corners. So it's very much more exciting, feels a lot more fair, even though there's still plenty of ridiculous, outrageous stuff that happens. And it isn't as crazy as Mario Kart Wii, because it's 8 instead of 12. 12. I think, you know, that was another thing probably that made the Grand Prix even more sort of mad in the Wii game was 12 people, these 12 people launching items or 11.
Well, and that means four more people who are near the back of the pack, right?
Yeah.
So they're getting the really good overpowered items and using them all the time. And that's why it felt worse when you're up near the front. Yeah, I just feel like, you know, if they're not going to take any effort to make the Grand Prix creative and fun to play and satisfying, then don't put carrots in there, like unlockable items and characters and stuff like that, to entice me to play through that content, because it feels like work in a very bad way.
Or give you other ways to do it.
Yeah, like in Smash Brothers. In Smash Brothers, you can just play multiplayer and unlock everything.
They've got the coins there. What if they said you could also spend the coins on characters if you wanted to?
Yeah.
As well as the cart parts or something like that. They could easily have done that. So obviously you'd prefer them to actually differentiate the single player content and make it kind of meaningful. But if they can't, then at least, you know, make it as optional as possible. And I think they've gone, it is more optional for me than it has been in other games in terms of, you know, all the classes are unlocked from the start and it's only characters.
Mm-hmm. Now, have they ever said why they're not going back to that Double Dash style of play?
Oh, people hated it.
Well, I mean, for a handheld, it's a bit tricky in terms of, I don't think it's... You could still do co-op, of course, but it's not as natural, is it, for them to focus on that. But I do think for the Wii U game, they really should bring it back as a discrete mode. You don't have to have the whole thing right. be about the double carts and two people and all that, even when you're playing by yourself. But have it as a separate co-op mode where you have the Double Dash thing. And I've said before, there's applications with the tablet controller where you could have someone like looking behind you and firing shells at your opponents like directly with that controller and stuff. I mean, it's just begging for it, but it doesn't have to be the whole game.
Right.
Just a mode. Yeah,
but Mario Kart co-op is just so much fun, and if you've never tried it, man, totally worth digging out Double Dash and hooking up a couple controllers. It's great. There's a lot more you could do with that idea. So anyway, Mario Kart 7, it is really good for multiplayer, and thankfully with the online being as good as it is, almost everyone can actually enjoy the multiplayer now. But as a single player, I mean, the Grand Prix stuff is just abysmal. I think it's fucking terrible. I really do. I played it for probably 2 hours last night and was extremely unhappy about it. So I think if you're buying this because you want to play through the Grand Prix stuff, don't. Please. Just save yourself.
You're better off doing time trial, I think, if you do something by yourself. Because what they do is they distribute these ghost things from Spot Pass to kind of prod you to try it once and then set a time. And then, of course, if you street pass with people, the times will propagate and you've got something to race against and all that. And that's, I'm sure that's more rewarding on your own, actually. As I said last week, these tracks have quite a lot of different routes, different strategies you could apply, you know, finding what works best for shaving seconds off your time. I think that's gotta be much more rewarding, especially with the track design in this game, than just doing the Grand Prix.
I can see that, but at the same time, I've done time trial in other Mario Kart games, and I usually find it to be a little bit dry, you know, just because there's no one else on the track, and the tracks themselves aren't, I mean, they're interactive.
That is the one thing about the ghost thing from the Spot Pass, is you actually get like seven others, you know.
Oh, seven ghosts at the same time?
Seven ghosts to race against. Holy shit. You know, some of them you will, like, lap if you do well.
Oh, that's cool.
Presumably, if you street pass with people, you'll be racing against their ghosts, or maybe racing against the, you know, if you street pass with enough people, if you're fortunate enough, you could actually race against seven ghosts of people you've street passed with or something. So, you know, I mean, that sounds, it might make it a little less dry. But, I mean, it's time trial stuff. I mean, it is what it is. So I'm not going to make out. It's going to be a kind of barrel of laughs, but it gives you, it does make you look at the tracks in a slightly different way. And then also, like I said, it's just, there's a lot more of a feeling of merit about it compared to doing a Grand Prix.
Okay. So James, you're up next.
So beat Zelda briefly as a warning to all parties here, make a copy of your save file before you finish the game.
Well, how deep into the game would you recommend before you absolutely have to do that?
Well, there's two reasons. One, when they start talking about dragons, you probably should.
Okay.
And another one right before you finish the game. Because at the end of the game, it saves over with New Game Plus.
Well, you have to say yes to do that.
Yeah, but how it words it's kind of funny. It says you'll lose your progress. Oh, well, okay. Yo, you lose your whole game. You lose your progress in that the entirety of the gameplay experience.
Yeah.
That's mostly Nintendo's weird, archaic saving. I mean, I don't know why they did it that way, but they did.
So you're saying make a backup in case you want to go back to close to the end of the game and do more side quests or just experience the final parts over again.
Exactly.
Okay.
But you still want to be able to play New Game Plus.
So you say New Game Plus, but is this just a harder mode, or do you actually carry stuff over?
You carry over some stuff, yes.
You carry over those materials you were talking about, Johnny.
Well, yeah, great.
But don't you carry over a lot of your upgrades, too?
I don't think so. I think it's mostly just bugs and materials.
Don't you carry over stuff like the wallet upgrades and things?
Oh, well, maybe that. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that.
That might be okay, but New Game Plus makes little sense in a game like Zelda because it's so gated on the items that you get.
The main thing of it is that it is harder, as Johnny said, because you don't find hearts just lying about anymore.
No, and everything does double damage.
Do you start with all your hearts? No, you wouldn't because the bosses drop hearts.
No, you start with 6 hearts, which is what this game starts with.
Yeah, yeah.
But effectively, it's like starting with 3. and the thing is, this game actually can be a little abusive in the amount of damage you take in the regular mode.
Sure, yeah.
So in the hard mode, shit, you better keep track of where all those chairs are.
yeah, I didn't realize that the chairs refilled refilled your health until pretty late in the game. And I was like, why are there always these stools next to the save points?
They're great. I love them.
And then there's a point where I spent about 10 minutes grinding barrels for hearts before a boss battle. And then I finally filled up my heart meter. It took forever. And then I went over to the save point, and then I looked over at that thing, and I'm like, what happens if I just sit on that thing? And then I felt really stupid. I also laughed a lot because there's an amazing idle animation when you let Link sit down for too long. Amazing. If you haven't seen it, go sit down on anything in Zelda and just wait. It's great.
So there's that. And then sometimes there are some places where he sits down and people interact with him while he's sitting.
Oh, yeah?
Or the game world will interact. Like, there's one person, if you sit down in her house, she starts talking about how she likes to be lazy also. There's some other ones where if you sit long enough, he'll interact with the environment in some way or another.
That sounds like a YouTube video waiting to happen.
Yeah, I'm sure it's already out there. that was just my fair warning. The ending of the game isn't abrupt, but the final boss battle, I was actually kind of surprised.
It's the very, very, very final parts are surprisingly easy.
Yeah.
Considering what comes before it is quite tricky and really quite cool. I thought enjoyable.
Kind hateful is probably the word I'd use for it.
Sword play, you know, top sword play kind of action, really quite satisfying. And then it's like, okay, well, now we've got more to come. It doesn't really up the ante from there a great deal, I wouldn't say.
No, especially since it lets you walk away and sort of recover before that second bit.
Yeah, I'm sure some people would be grateful for that because sometimes...
I was in rough shape at the end.
But also, like, with Twilight Princess, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, you know, it's like, God, the ending just goes on and on and on. Like, you know, it could be a bit much. And the thing is, like, if you just wanted to replay the cool boss fights I was kind of just mentioning, I think you could do that through the boss rush mode.
Yes.
Hey, Carl, have you been tempted by all the Zelda talk? Are you interested in this game?
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely... I'm most definitely going to buy it and play it. I'm just waiting for my vacation.
Oh, okay. That's not a bad idea.
I think my final time was like 34 hours, and I'd completed most of the quests.
Hmm. Yeah.
I had a handful left.
James is a speedy gamer, though. He
right.
I will take long. Mine will be more than that for sure.
Yeah, so setting all that aside, I have a feeling Zelda's going to come back up later.
Well, I mean, what was your final thoughts on it, though?
I enjoyed the game, but the padding stuff in it, it just felt so excessive. And the relatively small number of areas, and the fact that late in the game, you really only get to see one more area that's truly new. It's a little bit depressing, because it feels like there should be more stuff to see for the first time.
I like the environments a lot, but I think I'm getting a little bit of the same sense that I did from Metroid Prime 3, where the areas are really cool, but because they're no longer connected to each other in an organic way, they feel smaller.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you can't just transition from one place to another. You have to go up into the sky, come back down.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's something, I mean, what you can say for, you know, all the other Zelda games is even the ones that are heavily centralized and not really not very big, they are at least connected. You can always walk from one place to any other place. And you cannot do that in Skyward Sword. And I think you look at the map and there's tons, even as you fill in all the different regions on the map,
yep.
50% of that map is just blank space. There's yep. so much padding on the world map. Because all these places are completely separated from each other. And I think they really miss an opportunity to make even, you know, like in Banjo-Tooie, you have these gigantic levels, but there are these mm-hmm. secret tunnels that connect them. And it's really exciting when you find one, you realize, wow, this really is kind of one big world. And I think that's lost here. And it's yeah. something I felt about a lot of recent Final Fantasy games, even going back to like Final Fantasy X, where there's not really a world map. You know, you can't really walk from one place to another. You have to jump in the airship and just select from a menu where you want to go, which is kind of what the flying is in Zelda. It's really kind of just a menu to say, which level do you want to go to now?
It's a slow menu.
It's fun. I like the flying, but I think the design of the ground world is so segmented that it's really kind of loses a sense that you are in this world that's all connected.
Well, and to me, it's a little upsetting because they clearly didn't feel hamstrung by existing Zelda races and Zelda canon of what the world should be. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's really only, with the exception of humans, one return race in the game.
There's like two Gorons in there. I mean,
no, it's the same dude.
Oh, it's all the same guy?
It's the same guy. He just wanders around a lot. And to me, that's liberating. They could actually say, okay, we're going to experiment with these new races that were here before them. Mm-hmm. But they didn't feel the need to sort of build the worlds for these characters. I mean, there's one race that all they do is dig. And you'd never learn anything about them except that they dig a lot.
Wait, they have creatures who dig who are not Gorons?
Yes.
That's ridiculous.
They burrow. Gorons don't burrow. They just kind of mine, right?
Well, they dig a little.
They don't burrow into the ground. They don't dig holes. They dig tunnels.
There is a race that digs holes.
This is a very important distinction, Carl.
that's such an argument of semantics, whatever.
They created a few races that seem interesting, but didn't do anything with them, I guess is my issue.
Yeah.
Let me just say that I rate my Zelda games based on the number of Gorons in them.
Oh, well, you're gonna have a serious problem when you get to Wind Waker because they did not handle the ocean that well.
Yeah.
So, James, did you have a new game you wanted to talk about this week?
I do, because the review train rolls on even into December. And four different games arrived in my mail in a two-day window, which is weird. Oof. That's deluge stuff going on because the Black Friday deals came home to roost. What I have as a review copy, though, is weird on a different level. It is the most descriptive title in the history of gaming, Fishing Resort. Because it is a resort in which you fish. This is a Propay game, the people who made games for penguins. And it's
Yuji Naka.
Yeah. XSEED brought this over because they're XSEED, presumably. And we saw this before E3 at their office, actually. We have a surprise for you, and they pulled out a Japanese edition of this game. We're going to publish this.
Is this for 3DS?
No, it's for a Wii.
Oh.
And then they're like, but don't talk about it for 3 months. I'm like, okay.
Done.
Hard.
Yeah, sure, because I don't want to ruin your brilliant marketing plan for Fishing Resort on Wii.
So their marketing plan was they sent winter care kits to reviewers of the game. I didn't get one, I'm afraid. Before they sent you the copy. So it was like a kit that included things like gummy worms, like a fishing kit.
Oh, God.
They are a weird company. But basically the premise is you're on an island resort. You have a hotel room. It's poshly furnished. But primarily you're going to go out and fish. And there's 200 species of fish to catch in a bunch of different places you can catch them. And as you get better at it in this sort of endless ocean kind of way, you get access to more places where there's more fish. And then you can use your results of the fish you catch versus the fish you take pictures of to buy gear to get better fish. but in a sort of Mario Tennis Game Boy Advance. So the game gets a 10, by the way. In that sort of way, there's these like quests on the island, people you can do to get money, and there's these little RPG-ish things you can engage in. There's this bustling world that's taking place on the island full of NPCs that have nothing of value to say, but will occasionally give you massive amounts of money for remembering to take the fishing rod to this woman's husband.
Sounds like Vegas stakes.
There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot, everything's motion controlled, so you whip your fishing rod and reel it in and get carpal tunnel trying to reel the fish in. But everyone in the world is dressed like they're from a K-pop music video, which is fantastic, what? I have to say. Including the owner of the island, who's dressed like a 1970s Elton John. And your fish then wind up in an aquarium, which you get money for because you've apparently been elected the director of the aquarium in your second day on an island. I mean, it's just this truly bizarre mix of gameplay things you can do that ultimately all revolve around making the oceans a little bit less biodiverse. But it's a relaxing game because it's fishing. I mean, for God's sakes, there's not much to it. But there's just these moments where the game does something so truly bizarre that you just can't help but laugh at it. So every time you catch a fish, it plays a jingle. And then it if you catch a fish that's bigger than your previous record, it plays a more impressive jingle. If you catch a new species, it plays this ridiculous pomp and circumstance. And then your fish gets rated, and you get paid at the end based on how many fish, their rating, their size. If you catch things like sticks, your character puts this really disgust. It zooms in on your character, so their face is half the screen, and then the fish is being held up next to it. If you catch a stick, it's the stick instead of a fish with your character scowling, but it still plays the happy music and still rates your stick and still pays you for it.
You know, if someone told me to make a fishing video game, I would probably be this desperate to make it seem interesting.
It really does kind of feel like they just said, yeah, fishing's kind of boring. Let's make it weird.
James, how are the graphics in the fishing game? I know it seems like a sort of extraneous question about a fishing game, but it can be contentious, as Carl and Johnny can attest.
Oh, one time I got really pissed at Johnny on our event. I think it's the only time I've ever been actually angry on the show.
What? Wait, what is this? I have no recollection whatsoever.
Jesus.
This is a long time ago. Johnny, you and I were talking about some fishing game that Sega had put out, and the graphics were abysmal. Like, really, really bad. And I got really pissed off about it because, like, they're really going to put this out on Wii, something with Dreamcast graphics. And you were like, doesn't fucking matter. What are you, graphics whore or something? And I got super pissed off.
Well, you were doing roids back then, so it's...
Yeah, that's when I threw my Spence through a window, if you'll recall.
Yeah. This game does have a sense of the Jaggies a bit, but it's really colorful. I mean, it's a tropical island, for God's sakes. And like I said, everybody's dressed like they're from K-pop music videos, so they're really colorful. Dude wearing all pink with the 3-foot-wide pink afro, and he's white. But the fish actually look pretty good, and if you're actually just looking out over the ocean waiting for stuff to happen, it can be pretty decent looking. I mean, it's a fishing game, but there's a lot of other extraneous stuff to do that can take your mind off the fact you are playing a fishing game. Like, if you want to go on an undersea tour, well, you can do that. But you can take, like, a ship to go out to sea and fish, and you get access to different fish out there. Mm-hmm. Unless you're an idiot like me who went with the beginner's lure, which is for, like, fish right on the coastline and went out to sea and didn't catch anything except sticks. Which, each time it happens, it becomes progressively funnier and yet more frustrating. Because you paid good money to go out on this trip and catch nothing.
So it's much like real deep-sea fishing. In my experience.
It's like, great, I just caught an A-ranked stick. Perfect. Thanks, game.
Well, James, you just gave Fishing Resort more coverage than all other outlets ever will combined.
No, that's not true because of that kit they sent out. It got coverage everywhere. It was brilliant.
So let's move on to Craig, please.
Okay, well, a couple of things I'll mention just briefly. I did get everything done on Super Mario 3D Land, so I've seen the super secret final level after getting all the golden flags and doing everything with both of the Mario Brothers.
So do you really have to get all the flags with both of the characters?
No, you need to complete every level with both of the characters, and you need to get all the flags at some point with one of them.
But you have to play through the first world and the special world both as Mario and as Luigi.
That is true.
That is a lot of stuff.
That's pretty time consuming, because I've got almost all the gold medals and I finished almost all the special worlds. But is it worth me spending another 5 hours to go back and replay everything else as another character?
I don't know. I mean, these levels, if you're not looking for star coins, if you know the layouts, if you're not trying to get the flag at the end, you could do them pretty quickly. But, you know, I just did it every now and again, very sort of absentmindedly worked my way to the goal. It's like, oh, it's the 2 minute warning. Let me just flick this open and do a level. Oh, it's instant replay review at another level. You can crack, you can get through these quite quickly. It didn't seem too onerous for me. It's a bit cheap, but yeah, I mean, ultimately, yeah, you're getting one level for it. So ask yourself whether you think that would be worthwhile.
Well, what do you think about that one level?
I personally did find it worthwhile because that level is great. It's exactly what I want in that sort of thing, you know, like the last level of a special world kind of deal. It's pretty bloody hard. It's pretty long compared to the other levels. No checkpoints, no power-ups apart from what you bring with you. You get some bosses in the middle. And it's pretty wacky, lots of, you know, sort of more advanced things like boost your jump off a Goomba's head to make it, or being able to sprint so quickly that you can actually run over gaps between blocks instead of have to jump over them and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, advanced Mario platforming, you know, kind of stuff that you might have seen in Lost Levels or something like that.
The last level of Galaxy 2.
But applied... The last level of Galaxy 2 is... I guess it's somewhat similar. I think it's better than that. Because that was actually... There's a lot of sort of combat in that. There was a lot of, like, Hammer Brothers.
That's true.
Towards the end. There was some of that in this, but it's mostly just, like, crazy platforming. I really liked it. I thought it was a cool sort of send-off. And it was pretty funny. I read in some places, like, some people say, oh, it's really annoying, you're disappointed you don't get anything for beating the level. And I suppose there's some truth in that, but at the same time, the level was the reward.
Right. You already worked really hard just to unlock it.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they would give you. I mean...
Well, you do get the fifth star on your save file, to be fair, if you're into that dick-waving kind of stuff.
Who isn't?
Yeah, but it may not be glistening if you ever...
Yeah, if you ever die. Yeah, I mean, I died like 5 times in a row if I was trying to get a tricky star coin or something and bugging it up. I certainly would have died 5 times in a row on this level. Far, far more than 5 times on this particular level. But I don't know whether that would have counted or not. But not glistening, no. I can't wave it that far, unfortunately. But
please don't.
I thoroughly...
It won't quite cross the Atlantic.
I really, really enjoyed it. Again, it is symptomatic of the fact, much like with Galaxy 2, I did want to start playing it, so I didn't. And you know, did a certain amount of busy work, but at least the reward was really cool. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I really hope they do another one on the 3DS.
4D Land?
You know, the same sort of template, but maybe polish it up in a few of the areas. I think that it's a bit lacking in, like, some of the identity of the game is a bit borrowed from this there. We talked about the soundtrack last week. That's definitely something they could address.
Yeah, world map sucks.
I think bringing Yoshi in would be a natural thing. You know, they did that for Galaxy 2 and for New Super Mario Brothers, and it worked. So, a sequel, if they chose to do one, has a lot of potential. If this sells well enough that they think that this actually could be a really fruitful...
I mean, it has sold pretty well.
The early going is really encouraging. You know, it's the fastest selling portable Mario ever over the Thanksgiving period in America. And then, you know, in Japan, it's got off to a really good start. But we'll see. You know, obviously, it's a high bar when you look at New Super Mario Brothers. The key is going to be sort of how much it outperforms Galaxy, I guess, even though it's not really comparing like with like in terms of it is portable, but that's more difficult in the States than it is in Japan, but to which they sort of pay more attention is another matter, because sometimes they do seem to, you know, some of the things they've done with Zelda over the years and all that, they do like to focus a bit on that home market in terms of some of the more commercially driven kind of direction of their series. So if it can really bust open that 1 million barrier that sort of Galaxy 2 seem to hit their heads on.
Yeah, do you think it's just that Japanese people have come to think of Mario as being too hardcore?
It's a little unclear. I mean, certainly Nintendo have tried very hard with Galaxy 2 in particular to associate it more with the side-scrolling games. I think they obviously had the sense that people, perhaps because there's so many things with Mario's name on it that are all really quite different, that people in Japan regarded the 3D things as something completely separate and different from the side-scrolling games, which is true in some ways, but they're obviously, you know, very related in others. And again, with Galaxy 2, they were trying to say, look, this is actually, you know, really quite similar, but it's in 3D. Yeah, you know, in terms of the game world, not in terms of stereoscopics. Right. I think with this, you know, they are actually trying to do a similar sort of thing, but the analogy is a bit closer, clearly. I mean, you know, if you look at footage of the game in an advert, you are going to look at it and say, it does kind of just look like regular Super Mario Brothers, but expanded into a third dimension. So maybe they will be able to make that connection in a way that they have not yet been able to do in Japan between the two sort of variants. So it's really good as it is. I don't feel like it's, you know, unfinished or like disappointing in any way, really. I've completely satisfied with it, but at the same time, there's clearly a lot more they could do with this format. So I hope they do go back to it.
You know, and not only that, I was thinking the other day that I've had such a good time with 3D Land and I'm so impressed by it. I wonder if this could be the dawn of a new era for 3D platformers. I think the 3DS is maybe proving that it's actually a really good platform for that. Whereas on the consoles, we've seen that that genre has really died a lot. I mean, Nintendo is pretty much the only company really trying to do 3D platformers on consoles anymore. And, you know, there's a period when that was the premier genre. I mean, back in the early, you know, N64 and PS1 days, that was the thing to do. And now actually a lot of it has gone back to 2D platformers. Yeah. They've become really in vogue. They've had a really strong revival, which I'm perfectly, you know, happy about. But I wonder if the presence of a platform like 3DS, maybe like Vita, I don't know. But I wonder if maybe developers will start looking at, especially with 3D Land as an example, I wonder if maybe that will kind of be a call to arms, you know, to let developers say, hey, you know, maybe we could make a 3D platformer. There's a lot of new developers who are very well known, who have risen in the past decade, who've never made one.
Right.
I mean, if your company started in 2001, you could be really famous and kind of a premier studio now. You've never made a 3D platformer. And maybe now's the time. I don't know.
Well, I mean, again, if 3D Land's a huge success, that may be a temptation. Clearly, that's happened on Wii in particular because of the success of New Super Mario Bros. Wii. Obviously, Nintendo's followed it up with Kirby and with DK and so forth. But, you know, you've got stuff like Rayman Origins that's on that as well. It's on the HD consoles too, but, you know,
yeah,
they're trying to appeal to that. So maybe a developer like Ubisoft could come in and say, let's make something that cribs from that strain of Mario, possibly. But I think the fact that, you know, 3D platformers, it seems like even as well as Nintendo makes them, I think equally at the same time demonstrates how difficult it is to get them right. It's always been easier to do a 2D platformer kind of knockoff. Sure. That's why they were so prolific in the 16-bit era and all that. I think 3D platforms are just inherently more difficult to get right. And so I don't think we'll see any great groundswell of them even now on the 3DS or anything like that. But a few good imitators wouldn't be unwelcome, I think.
I just think it's interesting that now they're viable on a handheld platform where you couldn't really do that well on the DS, not very well. PSP, there just didn't seem to be any kind of real demand for it. You know, I think there may be a couple examples, but now that we've got these powerful handhelds and the genre is not really being served on the consoles, maybe this is a good match. That's all I'm saying.
It's the most fertile ground they've got. I know that you could argue with that. Mm-hmm. But other stuff, I did finish off the story aspect of Arkham City. I've still got a fair bit that I could do with that over time. But all I'll say about it is I was far more pleased with the ending than I was of the original.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite a lot more satisfying, a very enjoyable sort of experience overall for me. Other than that, plenty of Mario Kart. But I had sort of mostly good experiences. I've tried the whole join game function a couple of times. I saw just pulled up the friends list, saw someone on there that was already playing, like a random match, kind of piggybacking onto theirs. And that's fun, actually. You know, I mean, as I said, first of all, just playing online is better in general because of the way it balances out, even if they're completely anonymous. But if you've got one person in there that you kind of have some familiarity with, it does make you think about it a bit more in terms of, oh, wouldn't this be embarrassing if I got completely wiped out or something like that? A little bit, just a tiny bit of extra pressure, maybe. But yeah, that's been great fun so far.
I love how they keep a leaderboard for the community.
Yeah, I've noticed that too.
It's something Nintendo has done very poorly with this generation the past few years, and I think this is a huge step forward for them to say that you don't care how well you do against the world, because you're not going to be the best player in the world, or even one of.
Right. If you are the best player in the world, yeah, you know it.
You want to be the best among your friends, people you can actually compare it, people who might actually be in your league. So I think the fact that the community just has an automatic leaderboard set up so you can see, you know, who in the community is better at this game, who's doing really well, or who's played the most. Perfect. That is exactly what that should have.
Yeah, I like that too. And then another thing, I downloaded Pull Blocks or Pushmo, whatever Carl was talking about earlier. But there was actually in Europe another release for the eShop that went along with it, which is quite unusual, as you know. I mean, usually you get your DSiWare stuff and then one sort of eShop specific release per week. But very rarely more than one. But in this case, you got two because there was a Blaster Master, Enemy Below, I think is the subtitle. So it's basically the Game Boy Color version of Blaster Master on the Virtual Console for 3DS. So a couple of things notable about that. First, it was the first GBC game that we've had in Europe since Link's Awakening, which was kind of a special case because it was tying in with E3 and the anniversary stuff and all that. In Japan, they've had a few GBC titles before now, but in this case, it's just kind of popped up out of nowhere. Kind of interesting to see how frequent an occurrence that's going to be. It seemed like they were very resolutely sticking to the black and white stuff, and obviously they've still got an absolute shitload of black and white Game Boy games still to go through. You know, Wario Land's pretty imminent now.
It was announced for Japan.
Yeah, and then we've got the black and white Bionic Commando Game Boy game that's coming. So but there's loads of that there, but it's stirring GBC into the mix is back again. It's kind of interesting. And with this particular Blaster Master version, apparently it's not like an exact port in terms of the level layouts are very similar but somewhat different. There's differences in the bosses and stuff, but it is pretty much is Blaster Master, which, I mean, I've got the Japanese version, Super Planetary War Records Meta Fight. is what it translates to.
That's brilliant.
So I'm not desperate to pick it up. I played that quite a lot on Virtual Console, got pretty far into it. It's still kind of tempting. I think I didn't finish it on the Japanese Virtual Console, so I might be more apt to finish it portably.
You do, Greg.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. Maybe if I could chip away at it handheld, I might do it. And it is a little different, but also, you know, a pretty faithful version. We're faithful to what's good about the game. Other than that, I did want to mention as well, Japan's Virtual Console rolls on, and this month is going to be Mega Man X2, so we're going to be sure to pick that up. Absolutely will be picking that up with all its special chip wireframe superfluousness.
It's a superb game. It is so fucking good.
I mean, the worst part is I own that game at least 3 different times and I'm still upset.
And you still want it.
That looks like another Capcom game that is actually going to. I know we're still in the middle of the Great Drought. It's been more...
it's nothing compared to the European
drought. It's been more than 6 months in Europe without a Wii Virtual Console game.
It's at this point, it's just comedy. It's like they legitimately are saying, how long can we go before we get called out for this shit?
And it's been more than 100 days in the States or whatever, but Capcom seem like they're going to pull off a bit of a Lazarus on this thing with Street Fighter 2 or Super Street Fighter 2 for the Genesis, and then they've got Mega Man X2. I think that's been... Mega Man X2 has been rated.
It has become the Capcom Wii Virtual Console.
Yeah, well, it has, but I also think it's become the Capcom releases everything except Demon's Crest Virtual Console.
I know, we're getting so close. It's just inching closer.
Here's 18 versions of Street Fighter, but fuck you if you want to play Demon's Crest.
There's only 4 on the Virtual Console, let's be fair.
But they're getting closer as well. It's like Gargoyle's Quest for Game Boy. You know, Mega Man X has got a lot in common with Demon's Crest. You know, they're inching towards it, it feels like. I feel like we'll get there eventually.
Hey, or Gargoyle's Quest 2 I would settle for on the NES. I would love to play that.
I can't wait for the press release that just says, no, we're not releasing that game.
I feel like we're going to get there. Capcom see what they're in for, whereas like, if you're hoping for anything from Konami at this point, I think you should probably give up.
But, you know, recently in Japan, there was a Hudson game.
Well, it was the N64 Bomberman game, yeah. Which, of course, Konami owns them now. But in terms of Konami's own properties, you've got a lot of things. Rocket Knight, the Genesis, Contra, Castlevania games, the fourth Goemon game, the Paradeus games.
Bunch of stuff on N64. Konami had some, you know, Hybrid Heaven and Castlevania, 2 Castlevania games on N64. You got 2.
You'd only ever release one.
Goemon games on N64. Konami had a decent output.
Yeah,
they're
out, basically. But good for Capcom. They've made me a believer. I think Demon's Crest, we're going to get it. He just popped up in Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3. So it's topical. It's got to happen.
If your question is ever, will Capcom re-release this game? The answer is yes.
That too.
Eventually.
You don't have to tell me what game it is.
But they're on a pretty good streak with Demon's Crest. That game has not, as far as I know, that game has never been re-released in at least 16 years.
Maybe at this point it's just a matter of pride. Like, no, we will not release this game. You expect it. It's not going to happen.
I don't think it's ever been on any kind of compilation or anything.
No, I really don't.
I don't think there's any kind of like Japan-only GBA version or anything like that. So they're really holding out.
That's why the cartridges on eBay or, you know, specialist retailers, they're still pretty expensive.
Yeah. Dude, they ported fucking three Mickey Mouse games to GBA. They had to relicense that shit.
Yes, they did.
To port the... And those are... Well, I've only ever played the first one. It's great. I love Magical Adventure starring Mickey Mouse, but damn, that must have been expensive to get that license and do the port and everything. Their own property, Demon's Crest, they couldn't be bothered.
Oh, Capcom is a beautiful company full of beautiful people who don't always make sense.
You know, it'll be really interesting if Nintendo carries forward the Virtual Console service on Wii U if there will be a renewed interest from publishers.
Yeah.
Now, certainly if they add GameCube, I think there will certainly be a wave of interest from people who had GameCube games. But I wonder if some of the publishers who were active on Wii Virtual Console will be like, oh, people are paying attention to this again. Maybe we should release some of the games we didn't get around to earlier.
Yeah, if you've got your typical launch issue where you feel like there's a bunch of people who just spent a lot of money on a system
that played damn near anything
that might be straining for stuff to actually play on it, then put out. So I hope it does. I hope that's the kind of stimulus. Maybe that goes into the calculus with some publishers that they would rather wait till such a time.
Yeah, but that implies they know what the hell Nintendo's planning, and I'm not confident Nintendo knows what the hell Nintendo's planning.
No, but you can still speculate on that, can't you?
All right, well, that's going to do it for new business. We need to take a break, so stick around. We'll be right back. SNL. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Starting with reviews, Neil took a look at Shinobi, pondering, is Shinobi's revival frustrating or fair? Over on the Wii, James Dawson took a look at Fortune Street, saying that it is the definitive Wii board game experience.
Strong sales.
Next up, from the land of the rising sun, Danny Bivens reviews the 3DS eShop game Hirari Sakura Samurai. Is this what happens when Punch-Out meets feudal Japan? It probably is, I'm just going to guess. Then Danny also has impressions for 3DS of the Monster Hunter Tri-G, demo that just went up over there with all the update stuff. So hot off the eShop, probably not onto your 3DS, considering it may or may not get localized.
Right, according to secret news there being it is actually a downloadable demo on a Nintendo platform.
Holy crap.
Amazing.
But it blows up after you play it 30 times, like one of Inspector Gadget's mission directives.
There goes my plan to play demos 30 times.
I love Capcom. They're amazing. Even when their demo is just a secret plot to finance the game's development.
Considering I play most demos about 0.5 times, I don't think that's going to be a big problem.
Speaking of new things you can download thanks to a 3DS update, Patrick Barnett has impressions of the 3DS Nintendo 3D camera, which now means you can shoot 10 minutes of grainy 3D video on your 3DS.
Can't wait.
Enjoy.
All right, and finally we have a blog by Andrew Brown called Custom Controllers and Retro Awesomeness. Take a look at these retro controllers that plug into your Wii Remote. So be sure to head over to NintendoWorldReport.com to check out all of these great stories, see the show notes for this episode, and find much more wonderful original content. Welcome back to the show. It's time to do a little bit of news roundup. We don't do it very often, and every time we do, I say we don't do it very often because it's true. And we only do it when there's really something big going down. In this case,
we used to do a news segment, and it went horribly wrong.
Yes.
So here we are.
Hey now, we did news for quite some time, and it was great.
That was a long time ago, Carl. So, very long
time. The burden of proof lies with you, Castaneda.
Yeah.
Sure.
So this week, it's not that there was a big industry event or some kind of Nintendo press conference in Japan or anything like that. It's just there happened to be sort of this weird confluence of smaller events that are nonetheless very much worth talking about. So the first one up is a little bit of a developing story, I think. So yesterday, as of this recording, Chris Kohler at Wired.com and the Game Life blog at Wired posted an interview, or at least an excerpt of an interview that he did with Shigeru Miyamoto of Nintendo EAD. And they were talk about various topics. Some of them weren't covered in the excerpt. They're going to be published next week. But the big revelation and the big headline for Chris Kohler, our good friend of the show, was that Miyamoto was sort of retiring from his position as a general manager of Nintendo EAD and was going to take a more limited role in which he would actually be more hands-on developing of smaller games with smaller teams rather than overseeing all of the big projects that Nintendo does internally. Since then, this story has been apparently refuted somewhat by Nintendo in Japan, saying that Miyamoto is not retiring, and at this point, I don't know how much of it is, but I mean, this is a quote from Miyamoto, so maybe they're just saying Miyamoto spoke out of turn, or maybe they weren't ready to announce this, or maybe he just didn't describe it very well in the interview.
Lost in translation a wee bit.
I doubt it was lost in translation. I think Chris Kohler is pretty good on that stuff, so he's interviewed.
No, I mean, Nintendo might say that it was lost in translation.
But the anecdote from Miyamoto himself is literally him running around the office screaming that he's retiring.
Right.
But then he says he has to say that because he wants people to be prepared and to take initiative, and that he's not always going to be doing what he's doing. Right. So there are quite a lot of ambiguities.
Put some shading on it. Now, as I understand the counter story developing, it seems more like Nintendo saying he's not retiring from his position, which technically he may keep his job title.
Right.
But his role will change.
What he said, according to Kohler, is essentially, I'm not alleging Kohler's lying or anything, but we don't have the exact interview yet, so I'm just having to
we
say.
We don't have the full thing.
According to Kohler's story, essentially, is that he is going to be handing over ownership of these projects to, quote, the younger people.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably people like Aonuma, and probably someone I would guess at EAD Tokyo.
Aonuma's not much younger than Miyamoto, you know.
He's
that.
Not.
he's in his 50s, I think. So.
Well, because he did, I mean, Aonuma took more of an overseeing role over the two DS games.
Yeah, he hasn't directed those games either. I mean, that's some of what's, you know, I mean, the point is really that Miyamoto has become sort of multiple steps removed actually being hands-on with these games a lot of the times, the games that he's overseeing. You look at Galaxy 2, and I believe also 3D Land, you know, Koizumi, who directed Galaxy, I don't think directed those games.
No.
And so you've got the layer, you know, between Miyamoto, Koizumi, and then the actual people directing the development and being hands-on and all that. So he has got quite far removed from it. And so what I kind of took from the remarks seemed to be that, you know, he might shift his role, you know, to be even sort of more distant from that sort of stuff, but actually perhaps be more directly involved with some smaller projects as part of kind of transitioning out, which is something. I mean, I remember we had an email about what Nintendo would do when the time comes for Miyamoto to move on or whatever about 2.5 years ago. And that's something that I think Johnny brought up, is the idea, you know, before he completely retires, would he want to get his hands dirty again?
Get back to his roots.
And perhaps do something a bit more kind of personal or smaller scale, all that. So it sounded perfectly kind of plausible. It kind of rang true when he was saying it. So, I mean, maybe that is what's going to be happening. The problem is when you hear that sort of thing, maybe out of context.
Your stock takes a hit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they had a 2%, 2 points drop in the stock price and all this kind of stuff.
Which they can ill afford right now.
Well, they've already had so much of a dent. I don't know what it's it's just a drop in the ocean.
But as you can probably guess, I'm actually pretty happy about this news.
Yeah, that's sort of the thing. This is really the best thing that I could have heard about Miyamoto.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the games that Nintendo's put out in the last 10 years, how many of them could you really say are Miyamoto games?
Well, they all are. And maybe that's not a good thing.
They've diluted him to the point that they're not really Miyamoto games.
Right.
I imagine that his role for the last year and a half or so has basically been, or maybe even up to 3 years, has been shuttling between, or either telecommuting between the offices in Kyoto and the office in Tokyo to monitor the Zelda and Mario games in development. And I have to imagine that's a bit exhausting.
Yeah, and he's heavily involved in Retro Studios' work as well.
Well, assuming they're working on something.
Well, no, they have. I mean, he was involved in all the Metroid Prime games and with Donkey Kong and with Mario Kart, of course. And, you know, these are games that he had. Miyamoto hasn't directed a game since. Did he direct Pikmin?
I'm not sure he did. Directed one since Ocarina. Ocarina is the last one he actually directed, isn't it? A game at all, I think, in any series.
No, he did not do Pikmin.
To me, what's more interesting here, though, is that this is more of a succession plan than even it's being talked about, because he says he's turning over what is essentially his role to younger people, which presumably that means there's going to be someone overseeing the Zelda game, it could be someone overseeing the Mario game. But what I think was interesting was his discussion about making smaller games, he said with smaller teams with even younger people. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if this is more a chance for him to sort of try to shape the next generation of their developers who are still coming up.
Awesome.
And try to get them that hands-on experience working with him directly on a project. So when he's not there anymore, they still have the experience of working with him really closely on something that right now, if they were working on one of his big games, even though he's overseeing, he probably wouldn't interact with somebody at that level that much.
Mm-hmm. Right. Here's a quick fun fact for you, just real quickly. According to the internet, the last game that Shigeru Miyamoto directed was Mario Artist Paint Studio for the 64DD.
Holy shit. I wonder if that's accurate, though.
Well, so my memory would just go back to Ocarina, which presumably would be around about the same time.
Yeah.
It would have been before, because the DD wasn't out yet.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, in terms of when they were being developed, I mean, the DD went through such hell.
I can't imagine Mario Paint Studio required quite the hands-on work.
Yeah.
No, indeed.
I said cyan, damn it!
I think one of the things, though, perhaps from the point of view of why Nintendo would want to put out something clear and unambiguous of, like, you know, he's remaining in place, you know, he's still going to have that high-level position in the company, you know, he's not, like, going freelance or something weird or all that, is that he also serves a more strategic function in terms of the sorts of things that he goes into with hardware development. You know, I mean, he hasn't literally built a system, like, you know, was it Kono?
Actually goes and works on
hardware. Actually took the lead on the 3DS hardware design. Now, not saying he does that, but in terms of, you know, what sort of interface are we going to do? And this, you know, clearly Miyamoto has had a very formative kind of role to play in that kind of process with Nintendo hardware for a very long time there. Yes. And presumably he's had that, you know, with the Wii U and continues to have it and all that. So that's kind of a separate realm of his right. responsibilities that they probably need to reassure everyone that he's still playing that role, because you want to have the same sense about the Wii U when that comes out as you did about the Wii, that this is crafted by master game makers.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he's regarded as the soul of the company. So if you were to ask who's the most powerful person in that company, it's not immediately clear that Iwata is, even though he's technically his boss.
The most powerful person in that company is Hiroshi Yamauchi.
Well, who's actually working there right now? Yamauchi just doesn't care as long as the money comes in.
Yeah, probably not.
But he's the face of the company. He's sort of maybe more perception than reality, the guiding spirit of the company. And he kind of holds, as much as I hate to bring it up, he kind of holds this sort of Jobs-like image that people outside the company hold of him. Like, the company is him.
It's true, yes. And I mean, I think even beyond Nintendo alone, Shigeru Miyamoto is easily one of the most famous Japanese people in America.
Yes.
Sure.
He's the most famous video game designer of all time. And yep. He's the Steven Spielberg of video games, you know. And for me, the reason this is a good thing, I've kind of been expecting this for quite a while, and I've been kind of hoping for this for quite a while. And I posted this in our talkback thread on the news story, but I'll repeat it here for everyone else. Miyamoto's style on developing games, which is highly publicized, you know, I mean, it's widely discussed and promoted by Nintendo and by Miyamoto himself, is that he likes to take inspiration from the real world. He likes to be highly experimental and create lots of prototypes and throw things away before he ever finds the one that he likes. And he likes to make drastic design decisions very late in the process and totally up in the tea table. Now, those three things, I think, don't really suit themselves very well to giant multi-million-dollar 5-year projects. In fact, his style is probably part of the reason that Skyward Sword took 5 years to make. Yeah. And I'm not saying that the result isn't worth it, but Miyamoto's philosophy is no longer really compatible with the economics of making a big AAA super production. And so what I think it's really good is that it means that Nintendo's going to be able to make these smaller boutique games with his influence, and they're still going to make those big games, and they'll still be really good. I'm not really worried about that.
Now, the counter to that, though, is that if the game only has a year-long development cycle, is he going to feel that he can just – let's start over. I mean, there's less to throw away, but there's really less involved in finishing it and just –
Yeah, but it's just so much more agile. You know, with a small project, you can make big changes because there are fewer assets to change and there's less code.
As a software developer, that's a dangerous line of thinking, though, because you end up turning a small project into a medium one.
But he's going to do it either way, James.
I know, but on a larger project, I feel like there's almost more flexibility to make these big changes, only because it's so big. It's not like you're literally blowing up the very core of the project.
That's not entirely true, though, because the thing is, yes, he would have a small team, but it's not as if he wouldn't have the giant mega corporation of Nintendo throwing money behind him.
Yeah, of course.
Well, but are they going to want to throw a ton of money behind a game that he resets?
Well, let me put it this way. The whole idea of upending the tea table, maybe the reason he has to do that is because he sometimes has extended periods where he's not as involved directly with these games that he's sort of managing. He's not even really producing these games, he's sort of managing them, right? So right. Maybe when he's more intimately involved on a day-to-day basis and can really focus on one game, he won't have to upend the tea table, because he won't come back a month later and be shocked at what they've done to it, you know, and that it's not fun right, anymore. Right. So maybe that just won't happen as much.
If you have a 6-month window to make the game, I just feel like you're less likely to say, well, let's try a different idea. I think you're more prone to say, all right, let's just finish this idea because it's good. It's maybe not perfect, but It doesn't need to be. It's not going to be the basis of a 40-hour game.
Yeah. I'm excited by this. I don't think this is a time to mourn the loss of Shigeru Miyamoto. I mean, when he retires and like literally quits then I will be sad. Then I will be affected by this. But as it is, I think this is a good thing.
Like I said, I think the fact that he's going to go hands-on with a small team of presumably people who have never worked with him directly versus those people who are in charge of these games now, who obviously did, I feel like that's probably better for the company long-term than anything.
Absolutely. You're basically putting a bunch of designers into Shigeru Miyamoto University so that when they come out of that studio, they are going to be freaking rock stars.
I want to go there.
Yeah. Well, and it's not like he's not still at the company. If they have a question, I doubt he'll just
exactly, yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not going to answer your Zelda question. Click.
I imagine this is going to get him out of a lot of bullshitty corporate meetings and, you know, stuff that he doesn't want to do.
I would imagine he'll still be at E3 holding his Zelda sword at some point.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
Actually, maybe he won't have to go to E3 anymore.
No, he'll be there every year.
They'll always want to trade off him, you know, as long as he's there. They're always going to. I mean, that's part of what this whole damage control...
But, you know, I don't think he likes that. I think he really is uncomfortable with that role.
Well, maybe he doesn't, but I think they would convince him that it's for the greater good. I mean, he's always been out there in front of a bunch of projects that whether he was really that directly associated with, he was by the by, if he's conducting Wii Music or he's doing this for Skyward Sword or whatever. You know, I mean, he's none of these are games he's directed, but they always want you to think, is, you know, it's from the same guy that did Donkey Kong and Zelda and Mario, you know, that everything they do is driven by him. It's a perception that they've tried to cultivate. They've almost create a cult around him.
Yes.
You know, and whatever his role is at the company in actual practical functional terms, they're going to want to keep trading off that for as long as they can.
You are right.
Well, and in a way, by doing this, they're sort of adding new initiates into the inner circle of the cult, essentially. I mean, they're really trying to create high priests of the cult of Miyamoto at this point.
I wonder if this opportunity will also allow him to maybe work more cooperatively with other big-name developers, because he has expressed an interest in doing that in the past, and I don't think he's ever really been able to because of his other responsibilities. You know, Fumito Ueda is apparently leaving Sony, the creator of Ico and The Last Guardian and Shadow of the Colossus. I would love to see him work on a game with Miyamoto. I think their styles are very compatible. Very. And it would be pretty amazing to see them actually work on a game together. And I think, you know, before, with Miyamoto being in charge of 20 different games at the same time, that's probably not very realistic to do. Now, maybe now it is, you know?
Well, my biggest takeaway here from actually is that not only will he be at the next E3, but my guess is he'll have his first small project to show off.
That's kind of what he promised. He said he'd like to start working on a new, smaller game and then actually release it within the year.
Within 2012, yeah.
So I'm sure we'll get a lot of listener feedback on the Miyamoto situation, and it's going to spur a lot of discussion. And it's, like I said, it's still a developing story, so maybe we'll have more information about it soon. But let's move on, because there really is other stuff. And any other week, I think Xenoblade coming to North America would have been our top story. But
barely coming to North America.
Yeah, barely. So this was quite a surprise last week. Nintendo of America finally said that they are bringing Xenoblade Chronicles to North America. It will be essentially the European version, the English version from the European release. And it's coming out in April, and it will only be sold through GameStop and Nintendo's online store, which is fine, really. Because if you want it, you've got... I mean, if it was a GameStop exclusive, I'd be a little pissed, because GameStop fucking sucks. But you can buy it through Nintendo as well, directly, and I think that's fine.
I had two thoughts on this that I've expressed, and I've actually gotten some pushback on them, so I'm going to say what they are and expand upon them a little bit. First off, it is incredibly incompetent that it had to come this long for this game to come out.
Almost 2 years after the Japanese release.
And 6 months after it came out in Europe.
No, it was 8 months.
The last story will be out in Europe before this game comes out in North America.
Yeah, we just got that today, the February.
Yes, we did.
Are you, James, are you thinking about importing that too now? Even?
Yeah.
Yeah, I am too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, still completely uncertain that it'll come out at all, because, of course, one of the things we talked about when we were kind of rating the likelihood of any of these games or, you know, any particular one of them coming out from NOA was that... would we be running up against, you know, the Wii U coming out, and is the Wii just going to be dead? So, I mean, if Xenoblade's coming out in April,
Yeah.
How much time does it leave for Last Story? I mean, it's still very much up in the, and then of course it might be, if there's a performance dependency here, if anyway say, well, Xenoblade would have to sell this many
after we kneecapped it,
or indeed looking at what it, Last Story does in Europe, which, as I've said before, it might find it a bit trickier to succeed than Xenoblade did, because it's not going to have the same groundswell of publicity around Operation Rainfall's initial efforts and all that kind of stuff.
And it's not sitting in this massive doldrum the Wii had been in at that point either.
And apparently it takes NOA about 6 months to localize from English to English. So yeah, you have to build that into the timeline as well.
So, I mean, it could easily be that Last Story and Pandora's Tower don't come out in North America despite this good news. Mm-hmm. But I think the weird nature of its release, we can take as a pretty much unambiguous sign that the efforts of Operation Rainfall and all that, the internet sort of enthusiasm about trying to get them out, is really what made this happen.
Yeah.
There is no,
well, no
way
question.
There is no way that this was their plan all along.
No.
Is to release it through one retailer and their online store at the beginning of the fiscal year, where very rarely anything comes out.
Yeah, this is like in the Excitebots garbage zone.
Yeah, I mean, there are exceptions. Mario Kart Wii.
Yeah.
Yep. Actually came out in that area.
But they knew they could release that whenever the hell they want and sell a billion copies.
Wii Fit did too, I think.
Yeah, Wii Fit was around about the same time that same year, actually. So it was a big thing for them. But it's worth remembering at that time that they had Smash Brothers that was meant to come out at the end of the previous calendar year,
yep,
but then slipped. And so you're not going to release Smash Brothers and Mario Kart at the same time.
No,
so it may even have been that Mario Kart was not intended to be there. Typically, April is pretty barren. Excitebots is a good example. They just put it out there.
A game that we didn't even know existed.
Very little promotion, and that's that. So the timing, the exclusivity stuff, all that, it just says that they have looked at it and said, okay, let's see if we can find a way to put it out in a very sort of limited manner, in which case we pretty much know for a fact we're not going to take a bath on the thing, make a little pocket change.
Yeah.
And it is just a trivial matter, really, of taking the European localization and releasing it on a US Wii disc. And then it has some good PR effects and throws a bone to some loyalists and all that kind of stuff.
Think about how cheap the distribution is for this game, because I guarantee you GameStop will not order any more copies than they get pre-orders. If you want this from GameStop, you better fucking pre-order it, because they're not going to fill the shelves with Xenoblade.
So, actually, this brings me back to where I was going, which was that I said the limited release was a joke, personally. And some people push back saying that Atlas's Demon Souls got this limited release and did really well. But my refute to that is, it's fucking Atlas. They don't even have a European publishing division.
Everything Atlas does is limited release, basically.
Demon Souls is such an extremist game, and this game really shouldn't be. But my expectation is that the people who were most impressed by the Operation Rainfall were GameStop. My guess is they played a major role in this game's release pattern that involved money and hats.
Wow.
I wouldn't be surprised in the slightest if they said, look, we'll give you X amount of cash if you make us the exclusive physical retailer of this game.
Wow.
Well, I doubt that very much. I think what's more likely
they've done it before. GameStop has paid publishers for exclusivity.
I understand what you're saying, but I think it's what's much more likely is GameStop saying, look, we'll give you a much larger share of the game sales.
Well, I don't think they just said, here's $1 million hat made out of money.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think anyone's paid off. I think it's a very logical thing, because if you know what Xenoblade is, you probably know where your local GameStop store is, right? So,
yes.
It, like I said, it saves Nintendo a ton of money, and it keeps a bunch of unsold copies from filling up shelves and then going to the bargain bin. Because what it means is, they know, I mean, because GameStop has a very rigid pre-order system, they know how many copies they can sell with a very high degree of certainty. And so, and then everything from Nintendo just sits in one warehouse and they ship it out when you place your order. So that costs very, very little to do.
They already own the warehouse.
It's just, this is a cost cutting thing. That's all it is. It just makes it easier for Nintendo to make money on a lower number of copies.
It's because, look, NOA past originally. This we know. Right. That's how it ends up getting localized by the European division, as has been the case for Last Story and Pandora's Tower as well. But clearly now what they've done is basically done a reassessment in light of the fact that the European localization exists, in light of Operation Rainfall and all that. And as I said, just try, how do we do it, a bare bones strategy that has pretty much no risk because all the costs have been minimized down to the nub. There's not going to be a lot of opportunity cost here because we're not going to be doing some big marketing push or all that. You know, it's going to be very lean sort of operation that they can feel confident. It won't hurt us. It can only help us.
Right. And, you know, that's kind of where I was coming from. With maybe GameStop actually came to them and said, look, we know how to make this work for you with minimum risk.
Is it, well, I mean, if they had sort of representation as well from people placing pre-orders on their website or some of the other stuff that Operation Rainfall was doing, that could have spurred their interest as well.
Well, and think about it this way. GameStop will get very activated video game consumers who are very well informed into their stores, physically in their stores or on their website.
Yep.
They get their most prime demographic to come in to buy a game because they have to go there.
Yep.
For them, it's perfect.
They sell strategy guides and, you know, magazine subscriptions. And so anyway, overall, look, it's a good thing. It's a good thing this is coming out. I'm very glad people are going to be able to buy this without having to go through a bunch of bullshit hacking your Wii, which is really not much fun. And
it's not that bad.
It sucks. You shouldn't have to do it. And now you don't have
to. No, you shouldn't have to do it, but it's not that bad.
If you can wait till April, I would say, look, it's a very good game, obviously, and I think it's great that people are going to get the opportunity. And if you've been thinking about it, go for it. So it's great. I'm glad Nintendo came around. It shows that they are human and that they have some smart to them.
And I still struggle to give them credit for this because I still feel like this should have gotten a bigger release and a more timely release than it did.
It certainly deserves more prestige than it's going to get, but
yes.
But the important thing is that people can play it.
If it was a big release, it wouldn't have sold well.
It doesn't need to be a big release, but it needs to be a full release. Like, no, you need to be able to go to a store and buy it that's not GameStop.
You know, if they made it a download title, I'd been perfectly happy. I don't really give a shit how much promotion they give it. I want people to be able to buy it.
But see, sure. I'm not sure you will be able to buy it after X amount of time. You're going to have to buy it, like, the first day it's out. It's going to be an Atlas game, and Atlas games are horrible to try to buy.
Well, it's not like ExciteBots where no one knew about it before they put it out there.
I'm not even sure Nintendo knew about ExciteBots.
If you're the kind of person who's going to buy Xenoblade anyway, you've had plenty of time to hear about it and to make your decision well in advance.
If you've been dying to play Xenoblade, chances are you've imported it.
Yeah, but it's going to be months from now before that game comes out. How much of that buzz is still going to exist then?
Zero.
They'll need to do maybe a little something to gin up the interest again around that time because, you know, you are looking to get, I think there are a certain number and it is going to be limited, and that's what James is alluding to. I'm sure the production run will be rather limited.
It'll be Atlassian.
In number, in addition to the, you know, breadth of its distribution being so narrow. But you are looking to get those people that are not the total zealots that would import it and buy like James or Johnny, but at the same time, yeah, maybe more someone like me. If I'd had to import Xenoblade to play it, I don't know that I would have done.
Yeah.
As it turns out, because it was released here properly, I bought it for a reasonable price. Because
Unlike Radiant Historia.
Because I had a lot of different options from where to buy it. Mm-hmm. A lot of competition there. Got it for a reasonable price. Played it and actually, you know, really thoroughly enjoyed it. And, you know, in retrospect, it would have been worth my while to jump through hoops to play it.
Definitely.
But you don't know that coming in.
Right.
Those are the sorts of people that they've got to tip over the edge to make it a success. And I don't think it's going to take some great PR blitz or whatever. And obviously they don't either. Otherwise they wouldn't be doing it this way. But there's going to have to be something.
They just have to send out review copies to all the video game websites and magazines. Because the people they want to sell this game to are the people who read that shit and listen to shows like this.
And moreover, they already basically know that it will review well.
Right,
yeah.
You know, in some cases, it could be risky relying on reviews as promotion because there might be a bit of a sting in the tail there.
I mean, I think publishers always know that going in, though. I mean, you don't send out a piece of crap and think, this game's going to get great reviews.
No, but here, I mean, you've got something that's already reviewed exceptionally well with a big range of outlets, including ones that aren't even European because people reviewed the Japanese version,
right.
Even... or certainly sites have reviewed the European version, even right. If they're not actually European themselves. So you've got a big...
We reviewed the Australian version.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a big swath of outlets that have covered it already. It's clear broadly what people are going to make of it. So you know that's going to be good publicity, you know, in the bank when the time comes. So that's true, Johnny. I mean, they can rely on that.
Carl, as the only person on this show currently who has not purchased and played some Xenoblade... Mm-hmm. This release potentially is geared towards guys like you who maybe haven't played their Wii in a long time, but would be interested in a game like this. What do you think?
Not going to buy it. Don't care.
Not your thing?
Nope.
Hey, it won't appeal to everybody, but I think it is a pretty mainstream RPG.
I can absolutely see that it's a good game. People seem to like it. It doesn't strike my fancy.
Yeah. Okay, so the next thing is the Zelda bug. Oh man, what perfect timing after our discussion last week of bugs and testing and patches.
I think it was the day after we recorded that, the Zelda bug thing. It was actually, so I was editing the show and that entire discussion. I was just really glad I brought up the other M fuck up as a sort of, prologue to what was going to happen with Skyward Sword.
It's actually very similar to the other M. Problem.
Yeah, it does sound similar.
Yeah, anyway, there's a bug in Skyward Sword where you get to a point quite late in the game. It's even past where I am. So it's roughly 30 hours into the game. And
it's the part of the game I bitched about a little while ago.
and there's a point in which you have a choice of doing things in supposedly any order that you want. And it turns out there's only one order that works. So there's one thing that you better damn well do first, even though the game doesn't say you need to do it first.
Yeah, as someone who did it a couple days ago, this is literally what the game does. It says, you're going to need to go back to the three areas and find... And this is a spoiler, so I'll give you a second to turn it off if you're not listening. But it says to go find the dragons, essentially. Which is why I mentioned that earlier, to make your backup safe. And... it doesn't tell you any kind of order whatsoever. And you can go to them in any order you want. However, the game seems to expect you go in the same order you originally visited these places. Forest, fire, desert. Because if you go desert before you go forest, you're effed.
I think I did that, though. And the bug didn't happen.
Maybe it doesn't trigger 100%.
They seem to have pretty concrete instructions on how to replicate it.
Hmm. Yeah, but I mean, the instructions are how to avoid it.
Well, yeah, but they said exactly, they released instructions on how to do it.
Yeah, but I mean, it may not happen also, because I definitely did, I'm certain I did the desert first in that sequence.
Hmm. Anyway, it's the kind of bug that, when you come up to something you can do in different orders, you should probably test all the orders.
Yeah, and it's not like there's so many permutations here that it would be impossible to check them all.
No, basically what the problem is that, you know, if you do things in the wrong order, essentially, a cutscene that needs to be triggered to advance, you know, the plot and advance the quests that you're doing doesn't trigger ever.
Hmm.
And then you can't therefore actually continue along the quest and complete the game.
You could continue playing, so it's not like it freezes. It's just that you can't actually move on with the story and...
Yeah, you will never be able to advance.
But the problem is the game doesn't tell you, hey, this is the order you should go in. It's a bad testing move. It's something that really logically should have been caught by any testing unit.
Yeah.
Very bad.
Yep. It's a huge oversight. Huge.
Nintendo didn't confirm it for a couple of days later. So obviously they didn't catch it.
Yeah. But again, I will say things like this happen, and the important thing is that you have a way to fix it. Oh, wait, Nintendo doesn't. And that is the problem. They're going to, I'm sure they will fix it in future printings of the game. If you buy it later, you might not run into it. They've done that many times with previous games. They fix minor bugs and little exploits like that. But... if you've already bought the game, and apparently a few million people have, this is really treacherous, and you're going to have to follow some very specific instructions to avoid doing it. Nintendo has no way to issue a patch, and what they're saying, I mean, at first we heard that maybe there was a way to send to like mail in your SD card and have them hack it.
That's what happened with Other M in Japan, anyway.
It is, yes. Yeah.
But currently, Nintendo of America has not offered a plan like that, at least not publicly.
They did just acknowledge it, what, a day and a half ago?
Yeah, I mean, it may be that if you call them and complain about it, they may make that offer to you one-on-one, but they're not offering any kind of like mass program because they probably don't want to get thousands of packages of SD cards.
They have to do at least a certain amount of setup before they would announce that anyway. So, I mean, it's entirely feasible. They're working on it.
It's a logistical nightmare is what it is, I'm sure.
Because it's a hell of a lot of a bigger issue than people who, A, for some reason bought Other M, and B, are in Japan.
Yeah, that's a small number of people.
Although, the bug with Other M wasn't unique to Japan at all, but...
No, but Nintendo in Japan did it.
So, I think this... I hate to say it, but I was right. I mean, this
No,
is...
you weren't, actually, because if you go back and listen to what I said games should not be released expecting a day zero patch. You should not release a game if you have already found the bug ahead of time.
Clearly, they didn't find it, yeah, but they should have found it, that's for
sure.
They
should have.
Say, they really should have. So I assume you've lost respect for them then, James.
I have, actually. I feel like that was a massive failure on behalf of their testing unit.
Legitimately so, in all fairness.
Because yes, not absolutely. not only is it something you should always test when you give a player choice in order, you just have to do that. But they could hack their own save files to reset and try again.
It's very disappointing, even though it seems like I must have missed this by a hair.
Yeah.
I think you had to talk to someone in the desert after you completed it, too.
Well, that is very fortunate for me.
Because there's a perfectly legitimate reason to want to talk to him again.
Mm. On the one hand, it would have spared me the DK64 bit, but on the other hand, I think... It's not that bad that I would prefer the alternative, let's just say that.
It is entirely dreadful, and it actually, in a sense, makes the fact that they add all this padding at the end of the game even worse, because it could kill the game.
Yeah, there is that, and it also suggests perhaps it was done in haste, doesn't it?
It does.
Those parts of the game is like, shit, it's not long enough, they've got to put some shit on the end to lengthen
it
a bit.
Let's not test it.
And I don't really, this side quest stuff in the game, in Skyloft, you know, some of the stuff that Johnny's talked about, you know, doing, and how Johnny and Lindy, you have spent significantly longer on the game than I think James and I did, doing some of that stuff. You know, if you want the game to be longer, it can be longer.
Certainly,
without the mandatory scavenger hunty bullshit that they put in there. Really do not agree with that whole...
Well, Greg, you're getting away from the real point here, which is that Nintendo needs to be able to patch their games.
Oh, there's no argument about that.
They have to be able to patch their games, and this is... It's fucked up that they can't. It's
fucked up. Perhaps the positive you could take from this is that if there's any, and this should need to be, obviously, but if there's any extra impetus required to get them to have a very formal infrastructure for doing that from the ground up, from day one on Wii U, maybe this fiasco will ensure that.
I hope so. I hope they learn a very hard lesson from this. I hope it costs them a shitload of money to fix all these SD cards for people and reprint the game. And I hope it, I really want this to sting, because they've got to get with the times. You have to be able to issue patches for your games.
Now, if you'll recall, there's a similar bug. Actually, it's a doing things out of order again bug in the last Zelda game. There's this like shrine room in one of the towns you can get stuck in because you do things out of order. It's really funny, because I know of at least three games that I've played in the last 6 years that had massive do things out of order get stuck bugs. Mm-hmm. And you really think developers would do a better job of locking down areas they don't want you to go into.
Mm.
Tales of Symphonia actually had a pretty significant bug that you could get through. But if you went right instead of going left, there was one path you could take to get to a part of the game they didn't want you to go to yet. And then you get on a boat, and you can't take the boat back until you complete the dungeon, where every monster is 25 levels higher than you. I got stuck on that bug and spent so long in that dungeon that by the time I finally cleared it, I was one-hit KOing bosses in the remaining dungeons in the game.
Oh, that's great. That's a good story.
And all I would have had to do was come up with some reason why that cave was blocked off.
Yeah. Or just let you take the boat back. Why would they strand you on the island and not let you...
There was some story conceit why you had to be stuck there, but once you got there, you were boned.
Or just give you a teleport spell to let you go back to any town you've been to before. There's so many ways out of this conundrum.
25 levels lower and just getting wrecked by one-on-one battles. It was horrible.
That's funny. Okay, well, let's move on. We do want to get a little bit of listener mail for this episode before we wrap it up. And Carl, can you read this this first email from John?
Okay, so John, a.k.a. Little Irvs, writes, "Hello, gents. Fantastic job on the live telethon. Your stamina and ability to bring in large amounts of money would make Tingle proud." quick question. We both saw Microsoft and Sony jump on the motion bandwagon late in this generation, but only after the Wii's proven success. What are the chances either are reworking their respective next-gen controllers with touchscreens? And would this negate any advantage Wii U might have coming out of the gate first? Really quickly, just before I hand it off to the rest of these guys, I would like to point out that Sony actually put in motion before their console came out in the 6-axis.
Yeah, they put it in there after they saw what they were doing. Oh, and it worked like shit.
And I will also say that I wish they had released the banana controller for the PS3. That thing was
cool. The Batarang, yeah.
The Batarang.
If they had some kind of Club Nintendo equivalent, the Boomerang controller would be an awesome, like, giveaway thing, you know?
But if that's actually fans, the controller you're going to launch your system with, Ridge Racer becomes, like, the 8th dumbest thing of their press conference. Like, if you're dropping that down to number 8, your press conference is fucked.
That was kind of Kutaragi's last gasp, wasn't it?
Literally. He gasped out the phrase.
I don't think there's that much chance of this, to be honest, because, first of all, Microsoft have struck out with their own different kind of interface with Kinect. Yeah.
Which is doing really well for them. Really shocking.
It's doing really well. And they're already developing its successor.
There are some really interesting sales numbers that came out about Kinect that I saw. I can't recall the specifics to hand, but basically they had humongous numbers last Thanksgiving and Christmas. Presumably they're going to replicate them now. But the sales in between were incredibly low.
Huh.
And that Move actually made a substantial sort of catch up on it in the interim. Well, obviously, that's much cheaper.
Really?
But there's some interesting numbers. I assume that's global as well. But, you know, it has been successful for them. And presumably, they're going to iterate on it. It's going to be both heard stuff about, you know, the next Kinect version is going to be able to lip read or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know why that would be necessary.
They're talking about integrating it with, like, Windows PCs, actually.
Yeah, so Microsoft actually, well, for the PS3 point, they actually have some more interesting numbers that came out. I mean, first off, Microsoft was only going to sell you one Kinect per Xbox, whereas you could sell multiple Move units per system.
Although I think that was the Move startup thing they were talking about there.
But what's interesting is they sold, I think it was 700,000 Kinect units in the last X period of time, including ones in bundles, and like 900,000 360s. Which means there's a bunch of people who are buying 360s who aren't buying Kinects, which makes you wonder, who the hell are these people?
Well, I think what's going to happen, though, as well, is that's the thing. With the next system that Microsoft releases, whenever that will be, it probably will be much more of an effort to say, okay,
it's one and the same.
Let's merge the two. It's going to be better, but it's also going to be in there from day one. Mm-hmm. So now it's not just going to be this thing that sells a shitload on Christmas or Thanksgiving with fitness games or the Disney theme park tour or
Once Upon
Star
a Monster,
Wars or
which,
all
which
that.
Is...
You know, it's going to be everything. And so I think they're going to be going down that road, the sort of fully realized Kinect integration rather than putting touchscreen or modify the standard controller. Their expansive strategies, you know, outside of the core market are going to be around Kinect and no controllers, not fancy controllers.
You know, actually, I do think Microsoft doesn't always get the credit they deserve a lot of times. People are like, oh, it's Microsoft or whatever. They have some of the most amazing research and development teams in the world. I mean, just huge numbers of people who develop products that never see the light of day. that are super advanced that found their way into Kinect, and more resources are being funneled to Kinect 2 or whatever they're going to call it, successor.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you'll recall the Project Courier, a lot of the UI people from Project Courier got shifted into Kinect.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, it sort of shows. And they just launched a new experience yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
They've done is they wanted to make the 360 a set-top box that also plays video games. Or an all-in-one. Like, they want you to have one box that does everything. And no one has succeeded in that the way that this might actually pull it off.
Yeah, it's 1995 all over again. CDI.
Yeah, but except this might actually work.
Yeah.
And but what they've done also is they have started to integrate all of their technologies, because the new experience looks like Windows 8, which looks a lot like the next version of Windows Phone. And they're going to start using – they've had service-based platform architecture before anybody else for over 10 years, and now they're leveraging it everywhere. Everything they've built for 10 years is now coming down into the Xbox.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, if you look at Microsoft, if you contrast them with Sony, it's almost complete opposites in that Microsoft just seems to be acutely aware of how to integrate their products together and sort of grow inwards, as Sony is the complete fucking opposite.
Just throw Blu-ray in there.
Everything about Sony is ad hoc. Everything about PlayStation 3 is we build it one piece at a time, and the pieces don't really play together very well. And there's shit you can do on PS3 that requires a PC. No kidding.
Did you guys read that article that said the most profitable division of Sony right now is the life insurance division?
Seriously?
Yeah.
Yikes.
I love – see, that's one thing about Japanese companies you just don't get. You can literally – every step of a Mitsubishi vehicle is built by a Mitsubishi product, including the ore that's mined from the fucking ground and the bank used to finance its construction.
So on the subject of Sony, they are going to be – replicating the Wii U tablet experience with the Vita.
Yeah, exactly. They see they're not going to do it with the controller. They've got it with the other device.
Right. So the controller for the next PlayStation will probably be basically a DualShock all over again. But it will have, from the ground up, it'll be built to support the Vita. And, you know, part of that is they want to sell more Vitas, you know? So it works out really well for them. And the Vita has a great big screen, it has touch, it has all the joysticks and buttons that a Wii U controller does. It's actually a pretty good substitute. It's more expensive, but it also does more. You know, it's a standalone handheld system. So it's weird because Sony, in a way, is oddly in a perfect position to not only usurp Nintendo's advantage with the Wii U tablet controller, but also usurp Nintendo's long-held dream of connectivity between a handheld and a console. And I don't know that it's actually going to work, but they're sure as hell going to try.
Yeah. And what's in the context of Little Love's question here, he talks about reworking their next-gen controllers and all this. So, of course, you know, the Vita is going to be able to, you know, sync up with the PS3, and that's going to be out well before the Wii U. Sure. So, you know, the Wii U definitely isn't going to be coming out of the gate first in that respect.
And Vita support is already built into the PS3 firmware. They sent out an update earlier this week that preps your PlayStation to work with Vita. And Vita's not coming out for another 2-3 months.
Yeah, but the question is the software going to be there, obviously?
Well, who knows?
I mean, that's going to be like some fucking niche shit. I'm going to develop a game that needs 4 Vitas and a PS3.
Kojima will do it.
Transferring or whatever.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know. The GBA was really successful. The GameCube performed sort of respectably in the States. But was that idea ever much of a goer? I mean, you can point to the technical limitations involving the cables and all that kind of stuff, but
it's just not a terribly compelling idea.
It's yet to be demonstrated that commercially that sort of thing can catch fire.
Yeah.
And the fact is, you know, maybe with Wii U, the fact that you are actually putting that tablet controller in the box with the system from day one, and everything that comes out is with that in mind, not so much with the multi-platform stuff, but even still, that is, makes it very different from the PS3 Vita connection. True. So I think they will still maintain, when it launches, that unique quality. Now, whether that's worth a shit in the marketplace is another matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a matter of this kind of controller is the focus of Wii U. And using the Vita as a controller will never be the focus of either Vita or PlayStation. So
no.
It's a box that Sony can check off, and it's something that they can use to kind of be snarky at press conferences and say, oh, we can do that too. But they're not gonna. Not in the same way that Nintendo will, because...
No, Nintendo's betting the farm. Sony's paying lip service.
Right. Right. And I agree completely with Greg that Microsoft's not even going to bother because they've got Kinect and they think that's better.
And they think what's going to replace Kinect is – I mean, they apparently think it's like the fucking end of the world better. Like they think it's going to like get you drinks while you're playing games and just make your life happy.
I hope the next Xbox comes with the short circuit robot Johnny Five, and he, you know, you play. He's basically like Rob, but on steroids. You know, he's like 6 feet tall, and he has a rocket launcher.
Only if it's the bad Mohawk period.
Yeah,
Johnny.
That goes without saying. A robot with face paint? Are you kidding?
Oh God.
Okay, this conversation got totally ridiculous. So let's move on to the next letter.
Sarah from Iowa City, Iowa, writes, "Hey guys, I was just curious to know your thoughts on gamers cursing in video game culture. I did not put much thought into it until I stumbled upon video game reviews by the Angry Video Game Nerd on YouTube. I find them hilarious and notice that RFN does the same thing where you guys liberally use curse words when talking about video games."
Not that liberally.
Yeah, that liberally is not really the word for that. Demonstratively, maybe, or ostentatiously, I think is probably a more accurate word. For,
profuse would be the word to describe
that
particular...
Yeah, that too, yeah. Profuse profanity, there's a alliteration for you. I do not have any problems
with that,
and I like the fact that many gamers like to use quote-unquote offensive language to get their point across when discussing a game. So, firstly, would you use curse words at all if you were not playing video games? And secondly, do you think that this is an innate part of video game culture as a consequence of spending hours playing very difficult games?
Yes and no.
Thank you for taking my letter. You guys did a great job with the Charles Play Charity Telethon. That was fantastic.
Well, thanks. So first, should we address the author of this email and the strange coincidence, perhaps?
As I've said on a previous occasion, it's not so much inside baseball as it is inside Peter Gammon's larynx. It's not, you know, it's very behind the scenes.
I think your reference is so inside baseball, they might not know who Peter Gammons is.
I don't.
Yeah, since he went to the MLB Network, it's probably even more obscure than when he was on ESPN.
He's one of the most respected commentators on the sport of baseball.
So, in years past, James at one point created a fake email account and sent a fan letter to John Lindemann under the guise of someone named...
Who had complained, for reference... John and I had been jokingly complaining that Greg was getting all the fan mail, because at that point, Greg was actually getting a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. He still does, really.
I jumped the shark a few years ago.
Around episode 220 or
something. So my response, because John seemed to be more offended than I was even pretending to be, was to go ahead and create an account. And I came up with a name and Iowa City, Iowa. And I'm told the name was Sarah. I don't remember.
Yeah, it was Sarah Miller. You know, it was
It was Sarah Miller. And the name had some significance, too. I can't remember what it was.
So, James, you affirmed that you did not write this letter about cursing.
I swear. And to be honest, I had forgotten what the name was.
I think that Sarah Miller burrowed into James' subconscious and is now a different persona within his body.
But keep in mind... I called my hit before I went up to base because I told Greg explicitly what I was about to do.
No, I believe you, James. So the question is this a real person named Sarah from Iowa City?
I suspect it
or
is.
Or is this a very erudite fan who is blowing us away with his acumen of the history of this podcast by playing this little joke? I'm not sure.
I want to think it is, and it's just an amazing coincidence.
An amazing coincidence. I've seen our listener numbers. The odds are not good.
Now, James, you need to let us know when you start dreaming as Sarah Miller.
I sent 2 emails, 3 years ago now?
Oh, it's getting up for 4. I think it was quite early on in the days. Yeah, 3.5.
I remember the reveal was on 103.
I've done much trollier things to John since then. if you all could see the emails I send just John Lindemann. Explicitly designed to troll him.
One day there will be a museum exhibit. But anyway, I really appreciate the email. And if indeed this is a reference to the Sarah from Iowa City from all those years ago, it's pretty amazing. And I say, well done to you, whoever came up with this idea.
And if it's not, thank you for listening, Sarah.
Yes, thank you indeed. If you are actually a real person, we appreciate you, and I'm sorry to have dragged your name through the weird muck of this story. So anyway, I do actually, either way, I think the email is really fascinating, and I thought it was worth discussing. So why do we curse so fucking much? Well, the answer is yes, I would still curse if I didn't play video games. I might curse a lot less. I would still curse. And for me, it's not so much the games. It's just talking to these guys and being friends with them and spending time with them and getting really passionate about the things that we talk about on this show. And that's what leads me to do it. And I will say, I wish I didn't curse so much. And it's not because I have a moral problem with it. It's because I think it's kind of a lazy way of expressing yourself. It's a shortcut to impassioned speech. You know, it's kind of you're grasping at your vocabulary for the right thing to say, and that's all. And curse words are always the closest thing that have the most impact.
Sometimes they are the right thing to say.
Maybe so, but they're generally a shortcut, and there's usually a better word you could have used. But
look, the fact is, fuck is just another way of saying
some people.
For some, yes.
As you might be able to guess from my family name, I come from Irish descent on my father's side, so I'm sure some sort of swearing is just hardwired into me genetically.
Fuck you, you fucking gobshite.
If I was going to pick a hobby or an interest of mine...
I know where this is going.
If that would ever sort of lead me to swear more generally from an early age, it sure as hell isn't video games.
It's the Buffalo Bills.
If you hear me during a Bills fan, it'd make Joe Pesci blush. It's that bad. So, being predominantly a Nintendo gamer still, even having owned a PS3 for a couple of years and whatnot, I mean, I barely play games with dialogue in them. You know, there's not a lot of swearing from the games that could possibly do any damage.
I think she's referencing more the difficulty in
some
games.
Yeah, I know, the Ghouls and Ghosts effect or whatever, but there's...
When I was a kid, I swore at that game profusely because I had to, because it was the only way I could keep swearing. Does, if you're in pain or in distress or angry, it does have a calming effect that allows you.
There's studies, isn't there?
It allows you to cope with the stress of what you're doing.
Your brain releases chemicals that make you feel better.
Yeah.
And if you're playing that game, you need chemicals released, primarily barbiturates, because you're going to want to destroy it.
Yeah. You know, I think philosophically, I think it is fair to say that cursing is a part of video game culture. Now, that's not to say everyone who plays video games curses a lot. You know, I think if you're cursing at a game, in some sense, that means that it's working on you, and that, you know,
the game's winning.
It is eliciting an enthusiasm and maybe an emotional response, and it means that you care about what's happening. You may be really pissed off about what's happening, but you care. You're into it. Like, you're engaged with this game. And cursing is one evidence of that. It's not the only one, obviously. But you're not going to curse at something if you feel totally blasé about it and can't be bothered to comment.
Now, the only time I've cursed at games I don't give a crap about is when they go horribly wrong and I have to play them more.
The King of Clubs.
Yeah. Like, when that game froze on me one time and I realized I was going to have to replay that whole stage, I swore.
Yeah.
But... personally, I swear a lot on the show, and some of it is kind of stagey.
Yeah.
John, you've seen me in person. I don't swear nearly as much as I do on the show.
No, I think most of what you say is sort of, not, let's say, less than earnest.
Bombastic is the word I like to use.
Yes. I think James, you're a fairly exaggerated personality.
James is the TO of the show. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not speaking out of my own. Like, I'm not saying things I don't believe. I just you have to have a bit of a personality if you're going to be on a show like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just have to. Mm-hmm.
It helps.
Because, I mean, I can sit in a conversation and listen to it for 40 minutes and feel perfectly engaged and not say anything.
Right.
Can't do that here unless you're John Lindemann.
Yeah, I knew it was going from a mile away. From a mile away.
I would say...
like a bus about to crash across the highway. You could see that coming.
Full of orphans and puppies, right?
I would say that John Lindemann is actually more intense in person than he is on a podcast.
Absolutely.
Oh, so intense in person. He is almost unmanageably intense in person. Dude, look what I have just downloaded on my PSP. It is Cho fucking Aniki.
I often like hang out with John in person and wish he was more like that on the show. Really?
Oh, no.
Really?
He only goes to live action John Lindemann on the show for laughs on the show. It's like, no, this is what you're like.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what he's really like.
Live action John Lindemann. Can we get like a figure of that, mind?
It does kind of go back to the fact when I met John Lindemann, he was in his boxers and did not seem bothered by this scenario at all. I was deeply upset by it. I was like, what in the fuck is happening
this
right now?
This explains so much. Carl, do you find that you curse at games a lot?
No, not really. I'm not easily frustrated, I guess. And so I would say I probably curse most during podcasts.
Think about what you're doing when you do a podcast. Number one, you're performing. You're trying to get people's attention and you're trying to assert yourself. That's very important when you're on a podcast, and cursing is one way to do it. But also, you're talking with your friends about things you're really passionate about.
Right, right.
You know, when I talk to people in real life and I get really passionate about it, I curse too. So to me, it's kind of a sign that I'm comfortable with the people I'm with and also that I really care about what I'm talking about. Anyway, Sarah, if that is your real name, it is a point well observed, and I think it's an interesting topic, and maybe this is an area where we could get some more correspondence, either in TalkBack or through email or Twitter or whatever, and, you know, kind of let us know, do you find that you curse more when you play games? Do you think, this kind of feeds into an interesting question of, it's in parallel with the whole violent video games thing, but, you know, like, could gaming be a bad influence? If you think cursing is in poor form and is bad socially, could gaming be a bad influence on you? Is this something that you kind of have to fight the influence of? You know?
Does this mean that Jack Thompson is going to try and ban the Buffalo Bills?
I have a joke. I'm not going to make it. I would feel bad.
I would say cursing certainly not unique to video game culture, but I think it is possibly – I think you could argue that it is part of it.
I mean, I know it's not in vogue to say video games are for kids anymore, but it's still more youth-affiliated than most popular media
forms. Well, and unfortunately, the effect that happens when adolescents get a headset and relative anonymity.
Yeah, you're called all kinds of words for a homosexual.
Then you get an explosive profanity that I'm sure is perhaps even beyond the angry video game nerds' prolific.
Oh, yeah, my first action all Xbox Live game is mute everyone I don't know.
Yeah, and I would say that kind of stuff is not even really cursing in the sense that we've been discussing.
No, it's just being a douchebag.
That goes beyond. That's where you're actually trying to insult people.
Yeah.
And that's a very different kind of speech, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say a curse word, it's because it's usually because I really love something. You know, like I really fucking love this game, you know? So
right.
it's not meant to hurt someone. And so that, I think that's a different topic.
There is one thing I will say though. I did an episode at one point where I didn't swear deliberately.
Mm.
Like I had a note on the computer screen saying, don't fucking swear. It actually said, don't fucking swear. Because I thought the irony of that would be enough to keep me on target. And I did. I didn't swear the entire episode. And I went back and listened. I'm like, I'm boring. and then I came out of the gate swinging the next episode and went like...
You're probably just being too self-conscious about how you said things.
I went full 180. In the intro, I just went right at John before he even talked and then immediately turned my attention to just destroying things. I went Hulk smash all over the episode. Like, that was the episode, like later in the week, I got an email going, wow, James got a lot of zingers in that I didn't hear while we were recording. I was just full on kill mode at that point because I was like, wow, I was really boring. So I'm like, all right, no more experiments recording RFN. It goes badly Bruce Banner wrong.
You wouldn't like James when he's boring.
I mean, just to show sort of, you know, on a personal level, I mean, if you compare two podcasts that I'm on, Cross.comics Comics with my older brother, there's very, very little cursing in that show. I don't know, I don't curse very much when I'm talking to my older brother. But if you were to listen to an episode of Rough Draft, you would hear... much more explicit well, content.
There's some other influencing factors in play as well.
Yeah, no, by the way, nice stealth plugs there, Carl.
Oh, I can work them in like no one's business.
Well, indeed, it is that time of the show where you might as well get your plugs in, stealth or otherwise. So
get your plugs on, son.
So we do want to thank our people who emailed us, and we're getting some good emails lately, so we might have to do it again very, very soon. Hope you enjoy this episode. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we do highly encourage you to participate in the listener mail portion of the show. So before we go, Carl?
Well, actually, I'm going to plug something different on this episode. I've mentioned a couple times on the show that I work for a developer now, and our game is actually in beta if you would like to play it. It's right now it's up on Facebook. It's going to be coming to iPhone in quarter one of next year. It is called Ojo Agent, spelled O-J-O Agent, and it is a sports agent sim.
Finally.
Look, all I'm saying is there was a day when I with my writing in this video game, I was able to put in a Muddy Waters reference, a
nice
My Dinner with Andre reference,
oh,
and probably a dozen Back to the Future references.
So Carl's really, really up to date on his references, if you can't
tell.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. So now you have a reason to play the game.
Exactly.
Unless you're 20 or younger, because you'll have never heard of any of those things.
Well, you fucked on the short circuit bit then, aren't you?
Yeah. We really don't cater to tweens on this podcast very much. So yeah, check out Carl's video game. That is pretty cool that you're doing that, man. And hope it works out for you. And we've got Radio Trivia Podcast Edition just went up with your co-host James for that episode, along with TYP. It's been at least a month, it feels like, since Radio Trivia 100, so I'm glad that show is back. And I'm looking forward to listening to that. And, of course, NWR Connectivity, I'm sure they will have a lot more to say about the news stories that we discussed on this show. So you go get a different angle on it from them.
But they don't have Fishing Resort. That's an RFN exclusive.
Yeah, those poor saps. And of course, you know, I put out a call last week for people to create fake Greg Leahy Twitter accounts. And the response has been very, very encouraging so far. I think there are 5 Greg Leahys on Twitter right now, and they're all vying for, you know, legitimacy. They're all trying to one-up each other. Who can be more Greg?
I've not seen any real winners yet.
Yeah, I think there's one guy who's kind of treating it just like his own personal Twitter account. That's not working, dude. You gotta try harder. You gotta be the Greg.
No, I really think it's very difficult to pull off a fake Twitter account for somebody as someone who's done it.
Mm.
And it really took 2 heads to get that to work. It really took having an idea and going, does this work? Does that sound John Lindemann enough to you? No. Then make it sound more John Lindemann-y.
Yeah, so maybe that's a strategy some people can try. So anyway, I am enjoying it very much, and I have had a few very good laughs out of it. So I hope it continues. And, if you want to find these accounts and kind of view the action as it unfolds, just follow me. I'm at Johnny Metz on Twitter. That's no H, JONNYMETTS. And,
well, there's going to be one with an H now.
Well, that won't be the real one, will it? Anyway, I'll be retweeting the choice quotes from our various would-be Greg Leahys. It's really fun to watch this go down. Carl, thank you for doing this. Thank you for subbing.
Don't thank me yet. Don't thank me yet.
Carl, if you were on this episode, I enjoyed having you. And
it's going to be a very strange, abrupt pause on the closing that then resumes.
We will look forward to having John back next week, hopefully. So until then, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Radio Free Nintendo. They don't burrow into the ground. They don't dig holes. They dig tunnels.
There is a race that digs holes.
This is a very important distinction, Carl.
that's such an argument of semantics, whatever.
There is a race that digs holes, burrows. The noun burrows instead of the verb.
Yeah. Right, but if they were proto-Gorons, you would say, oh, that would make sense.
No, they're not proto-Gorons. They exist at the same time as a Goron.
And Goron.
Yeah.
And then there is a race that mines.
And Goron. That's going to be the episode title. And Goron.